just as a warning. I need one more stand hour before I go to bed, which means we need to end before midnight.
Well, you can stand while we podcast. You gotta get yourself a standing podcast desk.
Have you gotten the 9 o'clock hour yet?
No.
Stand up now.
Just run around.
Stand up.
That's true. That's a fair point. Oh God.
How long? You need like 1 or 2 minutes of activity of standing?
1 minute. But I gotta like wiggle around and make the watch think that I'm standing.
You should run in place. You can get if you're under your calorie count for the day. You run.
That's
in place
true.
A little bit.
How am I doing? How am I doing? Let's look.
Are you finishing all three rings on some kind of streak, or are you just doing stand? Are you still a blue ring stud?
Stand is the only thing I really care about. I did have a really good streak going for a long time, but I'm ever so lightly sick, so I've been skipping my morning runs, and so basically I'm just a sloth as I'm realizing my true form as a sloth.
It's a blue ring sloth.
A blue ring sloth, that's right. That's exactly it.
How'd you get the exercise minutes and not get the orange ring?
Because I'm out of shape, even despite all the running I've been doing. So getting exercise minutes is easier than you think. Wait. Okay, we're good. Okay, we can start.
You got
show.
It? You got like a badge or anything?
Everything is all right now.
Are you in we're the right time zone?
Who knows? Am I in the right country? Is this what people tune in for?
What in your preferred date format, why don't you put the year first so then it like lexicographically okay, so sorts properly?
This is a good question, which probably won't make the show, but if I were editing, would make the show. And this is why I don't edit, by the way. But anyway, the reason you don't do ISO, 8601, is because if you're doing something wherein you're handling like just an unbelievable amount of files, like let's say for the sake of argument that you had all of your pictures that you've ever taken in one folder because you're weird. So every single photograph you've ever taken is all in one folder on your, or one directory, if you will. Were they ever called directories on the Mac, John, way back when? Or is that just a DOS thing?
They were not.
Okay, so it's a DOS thing. Anyways.
What did Unix calls them directories, right?
Oh, that's true.
Unix calls them directories, yes.
Oh, fair enough. Anyway, I digress. So if you had any photo you've ever taken in one folder / directory, then absolutely, 8601, that bad boy. But in my day-to-day use of a computer, easily 90% of the time that I'm looking at any date, I know by context that it is the current year. So why would I put year first? That just gets annoying and redundant. There are certain circumstances where year should go first, but generally speaking, the one true way to store a date is day-day, month-month, year-year, because a day is smaller than a month, and a month is smaller than a year. 8601 is ridiculous, and anyone who says otherwise is preposterous. It is day, month, year. So, unless you are doing machine sorting, in which case, yes, 8601 is fine.
So what I'm arguing for, which I guess is 8601, I forget, is year, month, day.
Correct. That's 8601.
And the reason why this is better is that it is completely unambiguous, because nowhere ever uses year, day, month. So if you see a four-digit year up front, you know that the next number is going to be the month, and the month after that is going to be the day. In addition to the benefits of it being, like, you know, alphabetically sorted properly in lists, that, you know, that's a side benefit. But the number one argument for it is that it's unambiguous, that you can use that format anywhere in the world, and people will know how to read it. And the chance of error is very, very low. So that alone should win it. But also, you know, you're a programmer. The lexicographical sorting argument should work on you. And, you know, yes, you know right now this is the current year. Guess what? It won't be in a month. Like, next month it'll be a different current year. And if you have a format that sorts correctly, no matter what year you are in or what year the stuff you're looking at is from, that seems like it would be a win. So the correct way to write a date in a file name or in an unambiguous context is year, month, day.
See, I can't disagree with you, because you're not... You're not wrong, but you're also not right, because I just don't like it. I don't like it. And I'm the same person who doesn't put a zero in my URL slugs. So, I mean, who am I to talk? But to my eyes, I think we can all agree that Americans get it wrong, that month, day, year is just preposterous. It is truly and utterly stupid.
You're trying to make us all agree on cheese here with this? Because I don't agree on cheese.
Only you are agreeing on cheese.
What does that even mean? American cheese is delicious.
Yeah. Month to year is not preposterous. For file name, sure, it's preposterous. But for like display purposes, which is what we were talking about last time, you're like, oh, I sent myself to Australia, so my watch can display dates to me in that way. I don't want dates displayed to me in year, month, day. I want them in the U.S. system. And the U.S. system makes sense for display dates because...
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, it does. Month day is all you need to know almost all the time. And for disambiguation, hanging out on the right-hand side, because we read from right to left, if you need to look over there, yeah, there's year.
We read from right to left?
Or, you know what I mean, left to right.
No, you always go day, month, year. You always go day, month, year.
No, not in this country, and you shouldn't do it that way, because...
Oh, not in this country, but we're wrong. We use imperial.
Month day makes sense. Month day makes sense for display purposes. No. Not, you shouldn't put that in your file name, because that would be for the reasons Marco already outlined.
No, this is preposterous, John. The reason you say month day is right is just because it's what you're used to.
No, I'm saying there's an argument for it. It's not just like random or wrong. Like each one of these formats has its strengths and weaknesses. And saying that we can all agree that month day is preposterous is saying that there are no advantages to it. There are. There is a mnemonic. There is a sensible system for why that date works. Not just because we're used to it, which is obviously a big factor, but also there are things to recommend it, which is what I was just explaining. So it's not, you know, completely. It's not a completely write off. It's only completely right off in file names, because that would be dumb.
I can get behind month day when year is not a part of it. So March 17. Okay, fine.
But that's the thing. Like, you have that disambiguation. Like, it's month day, and then in cases where you feel like you need some disambiguation, like during the year changeover, or if you're doing distant future, distant past dates, you can throw on the year.
See, but then if it's month, day, year, how are you a programmer? How are you basically a robot?
Say for human consumption, for display purposes, not for naming your files, not
it's
for...
It's still
you
day,
know.
Month, year. No, you're saying month, day, year only because it's what you're used to.
By doing what you're doing, it's like, I'm going to do all my temperatures in Celsius. I'm going to have all my conversations in the United States in Celsius, right?
No, Celsius is barbaric.
No, but what I'm saying is, like, in this country, it's the way we do it. There's massive advantages to doing month, day in this country because everyone else does it that way. And if you do it the reverse, you will confuse other people and potentially also confuse yourself, depending on whether you remember if you wrote it or not.
No, I will concede that it is... unusual in this country. However, don't you put that barbaric Celsius nonsense on me. Don't you even start, sir.
I'm just saying, like, aside from the barbarism of Celsius for human temperatures, like, were you to use it, you'd be swimming against the tide in this country.
Sure.
And you'd have that same confusion. We should just use Kelvins. You don't have to have the degree symbol. There's problem solved.
All I'm saying is, I can see an argument for month, day, year. You're wrong, but I can see it. But let me make it plain that using Celsius for human felt temperatures, for ambient air temperatures, and only ambient air temperatures, is utterly ridiculous, and all of you heathens in Europe who say otherwise are unequivocally wrong. Look at the scale. Zero, it's cold-ish. 100, you're dead.
Yeah, there's that famous GIF.
Right. It's not even a GIF. It's just an image in Fahrenheit.
Can be encoded as a gift.
Zero is really, really cold. 100 is really, really hot. That's all you need to know. For ambient air temperature.
You're such a millennial. It's not even animated. It's not... When GIF is synonymous with animation, I like to triple take on that. Like, what is he... breaking my brain.
Sorry, John. I'm sorry we're kids. Anyway. Suffice to say, I can allow the 8601 argument. I think you're wrong. I can allow the month, day, year argument. I think you're wrong. But we should all agree the official ATP stance on Celsius is that it is utterly preposterous and wrong for ambient air temperature. You want to talk sciencey things? Well, you should be using Kelvin, but fine, use Celsius. But for ambient air temperature, it is wrong, and Europe should be ashamed. Let's move on and let's start with some follow-up. The root bug post in the dev forums, that was the dev forums, not the support forums. And one or all of us got that backwards last week.
Yeah, that was my bad. I think we all started off saying the right thing, but I very quickly shifted into talking about the support forums. So the developer forums, you have to be a registered Apple developer to even see them. Like, they're actually authenticated, so they're not open to the public. They are still pretty noisy. And it's also true that they are not a... hey, Apple, come help me with my problem thing. Like, it is other developers talking to other developers, and you have, you know, DTS support incidents or whatever for actual, you know, you pay money and then Apple can help you with stuff. So some of what we said is true, but it's important not to confuse the two types of forums. The completely wide open public support forums are high volume and very noisy, and people talk about all sorts of things. So dev forums are less so.
All right, and related, apparently Gregory Beatty emailed productsecurity at apple.com about this bug on November 12th. Do you want to tell us about this?
Yeah, a lot of people are asking about, you know, should Apple be poring over their forums or having some one or more employees look at all of the, both the dev forums and the support forums so they can see these bugs ahead of time. And a lot of people saying, oh, posting this on Twitter isn't the way you're supposed to disclose this, blah, blah, blah. What you're supposed to do is email productsecurity at apple.com. And it turns out somebody did actually do exactly the right thing, which is email productsecurity at apple.com about this exact bug on November 12th, which is a long time ago. And I don't know if they just have a big backlog or didn't get to it or knew about it, but we're hoping they could just sweep it under the rug until their fix came out in a later update. I don't know what the story is, but I thought it was interesting that for all the yelling about the right and wrong way to report bugs and the right and wrong way for Apple to know about them, this particular bug, long before it was widely publicized and long before it was fixed, was submitted to Apple in the correct way.
Excellent.
The quote-unquote correct way, because there's some argument that like, oh, you have to, you know, like responsible disclosure or whatever, where you tell the source of the bug about it first secretly to give them a chance to fix it, and only if they don't fix it after a long, long time do you go in the public, versus quote-unquote irresponsible disclosure, where you just tell it to the public before, you know, at the same time the vendor finds out the public does. And there is some debate about what actually is the best way to do that. Obviously, if you hear this, you're like, oh, well, of course, a responsible disclosure where you tell the vendor first, that's the way to do it because it protects the most people. You don't want the bad guys to have it, blah, blah, blah. But the problem with that approach in the past has been that the vendors are like, oh, thank you for telling us. We'll fix it when we get to it. And then you just sit there waiting, go like, how long do I have to wait before, you know, like maybe the bad guys already know about this. Just because I didn't tell the bad guys doesn't mean they don't, just because I discovered it, maybe they discovered it now too. And so you're waiting, come on, fix the bug. And then you have to know, how long do I wait before it's okay for me to say in public, like what this thing is, you know. And there was an article about it a couple of years ago, which was about the much more bureaucratic process of submitting things rather than the informal just email Apple policy. But I'm not entirely sure that the in this world where information is, you know, so widely shared and it's so difficult to know what other people know, like how long have, you know, black hat hackers known about this bug? We don't know, and they're not going to tell us. And the one thing we have learned from these type of incidents is that widespread publication of a bug gets it fixed really fast. And submitting it through the proper channels does not always get it fixed really fast. So I'm not quite sure what the right thing to do here is. It's not clear cut.
All right. And do you want to tell us about what Sean writes about XProtect?
XProtect, I think, is either the internal or external, both names of the malware system that Apple has on macOS, where they have signatures of malware and they periodically update that behind the scenes without you knowing about it. And I think I mentioned on the show, like, you don't even know that it's happening. Like, they're updating that malware whenever the heck they feel like it, and you have no choice in the matter. Although I think you can actually disable it or whatever. But on a default system, you are getting these updates whether you like it or not, unless you go into the system preferences and turn off the little checkbox that says you get these updates. But if you're wondering when they happen, people are actually keeping track of it, and you can look at this website. We'll put a link in the show notes that tells you when the updates are and what things they protect against. And there's even a little shell script that will tell you the last time it updated on your computer that you can run.
Excellent. All right. So Ian Williamson writes in and says, as someone who's previously had to join all of our company Macs to Active Directory in order to enforce corporate security policies, I wanted to confirm that, yes, it causes a multitude of issues resulting in the spinning beach ball. Recently, though, we're starting to disconnect them all and replace that with an Apple tool called Enterprise Connect, which communicates with AD in a much looser fashion. So in case you're not aware, because your name is Marco or you don't really have a real job, Active Directory is the... I'm sure there's a term for it. Is it LDAP? I don't even know. But it's the system by which many, 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 many corporate environments manage users. And it's a Microsoft system. And it does not typically play terribly well with Macs, which I think is slightly on Microsoft's shoulders, but is largely on Apple's shoulders. And so I know that my IT guy at my work has been complaining and moaning about Apple's implementation of Active Directory, particularly recently, because I think they might have redone it or something. It has caused him no endless amount of woes, and he is actively inquiring about this Enterprise Connect thing that apparently is only given to the coolest of clients of Apple's. So I don't know if you guys have anything to add on that. I'm sure, Marco, you do. So let's start with you.
I really don't. This is an entire world that I know nothing about, and I'm very happy to continue knowing nothing about.
I wish I could do that too, but alas, I cannot. Now, this was a response to me guessing why my computer was like slow to wake, and I got beach balls all the time, and I was attributing it to Active Directory mostly because I had previously had a Mac that was not on the Active Directory network, and it was just so, it was like a normal Mac, like a normal, it was a desktop too, so that also helps. But, you know, you'd wake it from sleep and it was immediately ready to go. And anyway, and I was blaming Active Directory, as didn't know. I think it was Marco suggested turning off PowerNap and Hibernate, and I did that. It did not really make any change as far as I can tell. So I think my computer was not hibernating and PowerNap was not an issue. I left the lid. I closed the lid, walked to my next meeting, sit down, open the lid, and then there's a fairly long period of time. Sometimes a long period of time before I can even log in, either with Touch ID or otherwise. I usually give up on Touch ID after I put my finger there for a while and nothing has happened. And then I type my password, nothing also happens. Like, I don't even see the little dots appear on the screen. But very often, it has registered my typed password. And if I just wait, including the return key that I hit, and if I just wait and wait, and eventually it will unlock. And then I'll try to do something, and then I'll get a beach ball. So I blame this all on Active Directory. And Ian was writing in to talk about this Enterprise Connect thing, which is trying to make a looser coupling between Active Directory. Here's the thing. I don't know almost anything about Active Directory other than the fact that I am subjected to it. I don't know if my company might already be using Enterprise Connect. I might be using the good version. Like, for all I know, it is worse for people who are not using Enterprise Connect. So I really have honestly no way of knowing whether I'm currently using Enterprise Connect or not. If I'm not, I would love for my company to use it. But somehow I don't think that's in the cards, because in general, like this time, and in the grand scheme of things, complaining that your computer takes a while before you can use it when you open the lid, and, you know, it's not that long. It's like, you know, maybe 20 seconds. That is a complaint that is probably falling on deaf ears in the grand scheme of enterprise IT. I just kind of wish I didn't have to deal with it.
We are sponsored this week by Fracture. Beautiful photo prints directly on glass. Visit fracture.me and save 15% off your first order with code ATP17. Fracture prints look amazing. You know, you should get your photos printed sometimes, because if you just post them online like most of us do, after 12 hours, they're off everyone's timelines. You'll never see them again. But if you get them printed, you have an actual artifact that you can hang up in your house or prop up on your desk, or even better, give it as a gift to someone who will really enjoy it. And this could be something traditional, like giving grandparents pictures of their grandchildren or their grandpuppies, or it can be something fun that you do with your friends. Like, maybe you send each other pictures that are inside jokes to you that you find funny, or just pictures of fun times you had together. Family, friends, coworkers, whoever it is, they make wonderful gifts. And Fracture knows this, so do a lot of other people. So if you want to get it done in time for the holidays, please place your orders now. Because here's the thing, every Fracture, they care a lot about quality. So every Fracture is handmade by human beings in Gainesville, Florida, right here, right in the U.S. They are a green company operating a carbon neutral factory. They do things very, very well. But what this means, having all this human, you know, hand involvement here, is that at the holidays, they get backed up sometimes. And so it's pretty close to the holidays now. They are already starting to get a large volume of orders in. If you want a gift in time for the holidays from Fracture, which I strongly recommend, because these prints look great. They go edge to edge. They're printed right on glass. You don't need to frame them. They fit well with any decor. They just look awesome. Modern, clean, high quality, great colors, great contrast. So you want these things. But you got to place those holiday orders now. Please don't wait. If you want them in time for the holidays, place those orders now. They are wonderful. So check them out today at fracture.me and save 15% off your first order with code ATP17. If they ask you where you came from, make sure to tell them you came from our ATP, our wonderful podcast here. So fracture.me and save 15% off your first order with code ATP17. Thank you so much to Fracture for sponsoring our show.
last week I got just a little bit fired up with regard to the keyboard behavior on iOS. I have two pieces of follow-up about this. Number one, I had assumed it was all me and that I'm just inept. And I had a tremendous amount of people write in to say, no, 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 it's not just you. It's become hot garbage. Now, nobody could agree on when this happened. A lot of people said the same thing I did, which was right around iOS, it was iPhone 6-ish, whatever iOS was around that time. Some people have said, no, 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 it's actually with iOS 11, which I disagree with. But a lot of people said, no, 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 you are not alone. I cannot type on my phone anymore. That being said, I have been mildly browbeat by Mike Hurley to try Gboard, which is Google's third-party keyboard, which is pretty good, but I haven't tried that, and when I am typing rather than swiping, I feel like it's not any better, which makes me think this is a KC problem, not an iOS problem. And apparently it's also a tons and tons of listeners problem all at the same time, because if I can't type on the Google keyboard and I can't type on the Apple keyboard, then that makes me think I'm the problem. Or perhaps it was that Apple was uniquely good at figuring out what I meant and auto-correcting things, or perhaps the touch targets were uniquely good at being the way I expected them to be, and now they're not. Like, somebody had suggested, I don't remember who it was, that maybe their touch targets got way bigger when they're predicting what you're going to type. So, like, let's say I'm typing the word there, T-H-E-R-E. Then, and so I type T-H-E, and the touch target for the letter R, because, you know, Apple thinks, oh, I bet he's going to type an R. The touch target for R is just mammoth. And if I'm trying to type they, then maybe I'll get T-H-E-R instead. Does that make any sense? It's very hard to paint this word picture. But what I'm driving at is, you know, predictive touch target enlargement is a possible explanation, though that is completely supposition, and I have no facts to indicate that's true. But in any case, one way or another, I've been trying Gboard, and it's not really working for me so far, so it makes me think it's a Casey problem, but I don't know if you guys have any feedback on this one.
I don't know if that means it's a Casey problem. It's like you said, that Gboard is a totally different keyboard, right? So that we have no idea how you are typing on Gboard, but you have the feeling, and many, many other people who wrote in also had the feeling, that they were previously better at typing on the Apple keyboard. And the weird thing about the feedback, like I put it in here, is like, basically that you're not alone, but incredible variance in the people. Some people saying it started 2 years ago. It started with iOS 10. Started when I changed to a bigger phone. It started when I changed to a smaller phone. And I don't know if you just tapped into some sort of like mass deterioration of typing skills, because there doesn't seem to be any common thread. Like, it's not like everyone agreed that iOS 11 hosed it. There was not that agreement, but lots of people really feel like they are now worse at typing than they used to. Maybe they're just all getting older, and this is like one of the first places that they're noticing that they're getting older. The only thing I saw that I think could be attributable to software is people complaining about autocorrect going behind them and changing their last three words to something nonsensical. Yes. And I've noticed that as well. And I think that is a new software addition, where it previously didn't used to, like, once you moved on from something, it would be like, oh, that's fine. But now it has like some kind of thing where it reconsiders the last five words you've written and says, oh, I see, you were probably trying to write this sequence of nonsense five words, and it goes back and corrects them. And that people find infuriating, and infuriating, so do I.
Yep, I completely agreed. I'm glad you brought that up, because I had forgotten about that. And yes, I've seen that behavior, and it is driving me bananas. Marco, any thoughts about this before I move on?
I mean, iOS changes autocorrect behavior in lots of versions. Like, you know, I'm sure iOS 10 changed it one way. iOS 11 changed it different ways. Now it does, like, the machine learning differential privacy corrections that are resulting in really embarrassing bugs like that, you know, I turning into the A box thing and the IT from it thing. They're going to work it out. You know, I hope they do. But, you know, there's definitely changes here, but there's been changes before, and they've worked it out. The only other thing I can think of that might be a factor for you is that you're also on an iPhone 10 now, which is a different physical size than what you were using for the last few years. So that's also probably contributing to just it's different, and your body has to get used to it.
It could be. But, I mean, this has been happening since before the Switch.
Yeah, that's what I mentioned last week, that are you sure it's not the size? And Casey said, well, it could be, but there are other factors as well. And everyone else who said, who complained about it was very adamant that, oh, no, it's not the size, except for the few people who said it was the size. But yeah, it's difficult in this type of thing because even if it's not machine learning, like, yeah, machine learning is the type of thing where it's not like a human program with an exact set of rules for it to behave. It's supposed to learn on its own and improve. So it's very difficult to know exactly how it's behaving because it's very much data driven. But even in the rules based ones, if the rules are complicated enough and changed often enough, it still doesn't really help you nail down, is this a better system than the one that preceded it? Did our tweak to the set of static rules help or hurt? It's kind of, I'm not sure how you'd even measure that. It's like a satisfaction, typing satisfaction measurement. You just use Face ID to look at the person's face and see if they're making a face like they just smelled something gross as they're trying to type.
Wow. Speaking of smelling something gross, tell me about your touch bar.
Ew.
What? Yeah, I don't smell the touch bar, but do touch the glove. No, smell the glove? Smell the glove. Sniff the glove? Come on, chat room, help me. I'm old and my brain doesn't work.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, I noticed I didn't even bother asking you to.
Yeah, well, that was wise. You know us well.
Smell the glove. Okay, thank you. I feel a little bit better.
What was this about? What is the history here?
I converged.
Oh, Spinal Tap?
Yeah.
I've still never seen that.
Yeah,
you should watch it. It's funny.
I should turn it up to 11 when I do.
Yeah, there you go. You know some things from it. So I just wanted to mark this point in time where I got my 2017 Touch Bar MacBook Pro, whenever it was, a couple months ago, and I've been using it. And I do, despite the fact that it's mostly in clamshell on my desk when I go to meetings and travel around the office, I do use it as an actual laptop. And I really feel like I've given the Touch Bar, a fair shake, despite continuing to hate the escape button, or lack thereof. But I finally did something that I've wanted to do since day one, but have been resisting, which is change that preference in the keyboard settings that tells it to, like, the default setting is allow applications to change the touch bar so that when you're in Safari, you see, like, Safari's thumbnails, and when you're in Mail, you see, like, the Mail buttons and all that stuff, right? There's actually a setting in system preferences, in the keyboard system preference, that says, don't do that. Just show me the system controls all the time. So the function keys and the media control and the sound things, basically making it like a little static graphical version of the regular keys that are on the MacBook Escape. And I resisted doing that because, like, look, if you're going to give the touch bar a fair shake, use it how it's supposed to be used. Use it in the default settings, allow the applications to do all their stuff with it. But who knows, maybe there's some application that you use that you'll find the touch bar really useful. And that was not the case. And so, and I was finding it distracting as the touch bar, like, changed from thing to thing as I, like, command tabbed around. And so I just changed it to be static now. So now I'm effectively using little pictures of keys that never change. And I still wish they were regular keys. So I put me down in the category of, I can't say I'm anti-touch bar because I just don't like laptops. And so if I had to buy a laptop, it having a touch bar or not would probably be the least of my concerns. But I didn't find a place for the touch bar in my life. I just don't find myself looking at that part of the machine when I'm using it at all. And maybe it's just because I have old habits or whatever, but it didn't work out for me.
You were talking with some people in one of the Slacks that we're in together, and you were talking about, it wasn't window shade, but I can't think of what it was. So let's just call it window shade. And you were talking about, you know, how you still have window shade enabled. Again, it wasn't literally window shade, but you have window shade enabled even to this day because you can't live without it.
Using this example, people are going to think I run window shade. Let's be clear. I do not.
Well, yeah, I know, but I can't remember what the hell it was.
You're talking about the classic Mac window layering? That's got to be it, right?
Maybe. I don't know. It doesn't really matter. The point I'm driving at,
I think it's classic Mac window layering, if I remember the conversation correctly, which people don't know what that is. But anyway, I'm pretty sure that's what it was.
So do you want to briefly describe what that is then?
That's just when you click a window in classic Mac OS, any window on the screen, if the window belongs to a different application than the frontmost one, like an app, the window belongs to an application that's not currently the active one, it doesn't just bring that window to the front. It brings that window and all the other windows owned by that application to the front. And that's how I used the Mac for 16 years before Mac OS 10 came along that way. And that's how I like to use it. And so during the entire life of Mac OS 10 and on into Mac OS, there have been various utilities that would change the window server behavior to act that way. But in the Mac OS X timeline, not only do you get that feature, but you also, most of the utilities I've used have allowed you to get back the other behavior. Because if you show up behaviors, I'm like, oh, what if I just want one window to come to the front? That behavior is, it's not what I want at all, right? It's just a matter of what you prefer, because with the tools that I use, you're just changing what the default is. So for me, Shift-Click brings a single window to the front, and just regular-click brings all the windows that belong to that application to the front. And some people may like it the reverse, where regular-click just brings that one window, and then some modifier-click brings all the windows. Or maybe you never want all the windows to come, but how I work, based on my habits, I want the default to be all windows come to the front, so I still do that.
I didn't even know, like, Shift-Click doesn't do it by default, it doesn't seem. But anyway.
No, this is the utility. Okay. I think I'm using Drag Thing to do it right now, but there's various utilities to do it. I think native, the regular Mac out of the box, doesn't have a way for you to bring all the windows to the front other than clicking, like, the dock icon or whatever. Like, there's no modifier click on a window to do it, I think. Mm-hmm.
In any case, the reason I bring all this up is because it struck me hearing you talk about this that you and many other like old school Mac people created these habits over the course of years that either because you're petulantly stubborn or just used to it, and probably both, to be honest, you just can't break yourself of them. And I am glad that the list of things that I have that are like that, I feel like is pretty small. Now, to be fair.
Oh, young child. Yeah. You think it's small because your world hasn't yet changed that much. Just wait until everyone's in VR and you're going to be like, I insist on using my fingers because I used my fingers for a really long time.
And you know what? And to that end, actually, the obvious answer to this is no, Casey, you still prefer a Mac. So you're old and you're relying on old technology. So your point is fair. But it's striking to me how you don't really like new things, John.
That's not what it is at all. Like, I think you're taking the wrong lesson for this. The lesson for this is, like, what is the advantage for me changing my habits? There has to be an advantage. There has to be a reason for me to train myself out of doing something. Now, one reason could be that there is literally no way to do it the old way. So guess what? Like, that's the stick version. You have no choice. There is no more of that thing, so forget about it and whatever. But if there is a way to do it, it's a trade-off. It's like, what is the cost of, like, enabling this way? Is it some hack that destroys your system stability? Is it something that you have to maintain and carefully, like, upgrade and compile from open source software? Or is it like jailbreaking, where every time a new OS comes out, you have to get a new jailbreak or whatever? Like, that would be the cost. And the benefit is you just get to continue to use your old habits. And it's not just habits in the case of window layering. The way I use Windows, like, my entire system of, you know, dealing with Windows, like, this is an important part of it. The fact that I can grab a corner of a window that belongs to an application and bring all the windows of that application to the front, like, I don't have an alternate way to manage windows in that way. Like, if I want to bring all the windows to the front, I've got to go down to the dock icon, but that breaks my whole system of arranging windows, you know, spatially to have to use them as sort of grab handles and to have locality of cursor and not to constantly have to go down to the bottom of the screen or to the right or to the left or whatever. So there are benefits to that system, and for this particular feature, the drawbacks in terms of system stability or maintenance of a weird program or anything just haven't been there. Unlike, for example, Window Shade, which I ran for a little while, but eventually it was clear that Apple was never going to add it, and you really had to add some really nasty hacks to your system to use it, so I abandoned Window Shade. But this I didn't abandon because it is a very minor change, very cleanly implemented by multiple products that don't require any hacks to my system whatsoever. And so I keep doing it. So the lesson is not never learn new things or don't pick up new habits or whatever. The lesson is, you know, don't blindly abandon the old for no benefit if they're, you know, if it continues to work for you.
Yeah, but the benefit is not having to do any sort of tweaking, right? Like, something that Dan Benjamin said years and years and years ago, which I don't 100% agree with, but I understand his point, was that, like, one should embrace the operating system defaults because it's that much less tweaking and finagling and messing about you need to do when you get a new machine, you know, because you can just accept the defaults and move on. And to be fair, like, I have a not insignificant list of software that I consider completely required for me to use a computer. For example, Alfred, for example, 1Password, for example, Dropbox. But in terms of, like, tweaking the system, I don't feel like I'm that particularly needy. I say that because I'm probably more needy than I realized, but I don't think I'm that bad. Whereas it seems like, John, and maybe this is just your advanced age, maybe it's your advanced experience with the platform, but it seems like you're more needy in this department than I am.
I think I'm using less stuff than you, as evidenced by my nice clean menu bar. But Dan's argument, we've had this discussion before. Dan's argument only makes sense if you are forced to live in a hoteling environment where you have to just sit down in front of a fresh computer every day and start your work. Like, we have migration assistant. We have upgraded installs of operating systems. Like, this is not an issue at all. Like, I don't spend time setting up my new Macs. Like, for the people who do that, maybe it's a fun thing they like to do. Oh, I just want to have a fresh system and reset it up. I never reset up a machine from scratch. I just do an upgrade install. I use Migration Assistant. All my stuff is already there. And it's not that much stuff. And Drag Thing I'm running anyway, because I like to have a thing on the screen that I can click on that just has applications in it, doesn't have minimized windows or folders in it. So I use that as a separate application, separate from its functionality for the window layering. But it just happens to also do window layering, so I'm getting a 2-for-1 out of that particular application. But no, there's not that much stuff. I have my favorite applications. I think I run 0 system hacks of any kind anymore. Like literally 0. Like, nothing is a kernel extension or a symbol plugin or anything like that. I run very few things that even display in the menu bar. I run favorite applications. I like BBEdit. I like DragThing, which is the plain old application with no weird hacks. I run Slack like we all do, whether we like it or not.
I was going to say, do any of us really run Slack, or does Slack run us?
Like, it's a fairly clean setup. And as we all know, it's not like I get new Macs so often that I'm constantly setting them up. And even if I was, migration system handles everything for me. Like, honestly, I don't see any particular advantage in being able to sit down in front of anybody's random computer and be able to use it comfortably, because first of all, it's not true for almost anybody. Like, if you sit down there and hit command space and Spotlight comes up, what are you going to do? Like, where's your Alfred now, right? Like, there's the whole point is it accepts software. You can install things on it that make it nicer to use. That's why we like Macs. And so I attach no benefit to being able to use a stock Mac comfortably.
So do you have your scroll direction as natural or the bogus old way?
I have the old way. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a setting that I set mm-hmm. once back when they changed that setting like 7 years ago. I've never touched the setting again because it just migrates from computer to computer. Like, it's, you know what I mean?
How long did you try natural scrolling, John?
Not at all. Like, what's the benefit? Uh-huh. Apple added the option for that. Why would I try it? Like, mm-hmm. Apple added the option, so I didn't feel like I had to run any hacks. If Apple takes away the option, guess what? I'm going to switch scroll directions, because what the hell choice do I have, right? But they haven't taken it away. It's still there, and I clicked that checkbox once many, many years ago, and I never think about it again.
So, Marco, are you natural scrolling or no?
Didn't we talk about this recently?
I thought we did, but I couldn't remember the answer.
We did, but Casey tends to forget.
Yeah, I'm also old scrolling because for the same reason, that basically, like, I tried natural scrolling when that option came out for like a half a day, and then I was like, nope, because
God, you're both so old.
For the same reason, I was already used to it, and there was no pressure to actually change. So it's like, why should I go through the hassle of relearning this when I don't actually have to? And maybe down the road I will have to, but when that happens, I'll learn it. Until then, I don't want to.
And do you spend time clicking that checkbox a lot? No, check it once, and that's it.
Even at the frequency I buy new Macs, it isn't a big problem. We are sponsored this week by Aftershocks Bone Conduction Headphones. Go to atp.aftershocks.com to learn more. Aftershocks headphones work by bone conduction. This means small transducers rest in front of your ears, not inside or around them like most headphones, and they send tiny vibrations through your cheekbones directly to your inner ear, totally bypassing your ears themselves. So unlike every other kind of headphone, bone conduction leaves your ears completely open with nothing plugging them up or going around them. So this is great, first of all, for comfort. For me, at least, I can't wear things that go in my ear. They just hurt. Aftershocks don't have that problem. They're also great for exercise and hot weather because they don't have some kind of giant ear cup making your ear all sweaty, because there's nothing actually resting on your ear. It's a little tiny thing that touches right in front of your ear. And they're also IP55 certified for water resistance in case you get really sweaty or it starts raining. And the biggest difference with Aftershocks, and this to me is what defines them, this is what defines whether they're right for you, and this will either sound great or awful to you, is that nothing is blocking your ears at all, so you hear all of the sound from the world around you in addition to what you're listening to. So this is actually not so great in like a very loud place, like a subway station, but it's awesome if you're doing something like taking a walk outside or walking through a city where you need to be able to hear what's around you for practicality or safety reasons. They're also great while jogging or while cycling because you really don't want to be listening to anything that's going to block out sound when you're doing something where the environment around you matters. Also, just around the house or around the office, you can you can do things like listen to a podcast or take a phone call while also hearing if, say, your kid upstairs wakes up from their nap or there's a knock on the door and it's the UPS person or something. So they're great for all sorts of situations where you want to hear the world around you in addition to what you're listening to. The flagship model in the Aftershocks lineup is the Trex Titanium and the new Trex Air. These are both great options. I've had both now. I've had a few months with each one, and you really can't go wrong with either one, to be honest. The Trex Titanium is a little more pocketable. The Trex Air is a little bit lighter and a little more comfortable. So it's really up to you what your priorities are. They're both fantastic. You can't go wrong. Both of them have great battery life. They have a 2-year warranty. And honestly, either one, you're pretty well off. So check it out today at atp.aftershocks.com. Once again, atp.aftershocks.com. And you can also use code ATP if you want to at checkout. Thank you very much to Aftershocks for sponsoring our show.
All right, we should move on from these turf wars that I'm starting. And why doesn't somebody tell me about this link about Johnny Ive and him hearing our MacBook criticism?
Yeah, there's been many Johnny Ive articles recently. Most of them I've just instapapered and haven't read. But this one had a quote that I wanted to pull. It was someone asking Johnny Ive about, you know, current Apple stuff, and he was actually giving answers. And so here is a quote from this article, which we will link. This is Johnny Ive saying, "Absolutely. All of your feelings and feedback around the MacBook you use, we couldn't want to listen more. And we hear, boy, do we hear." So this is not much of a statement, but it's merely confirmation that if you think Johnny Ive created the current line of MacBook and MacBook Pros and thinks they're perfect and has no idea that people have complaints about them, that is not the case. He pretty emphatically stated, basically, yes, I have heard complaints about this computer. And two things. One, we want to hear your feedback about it. It's not like we're saying we made a perfect thing and screw you if you don't like it. And two, they're definitely hearing it. So I think that was refreshing because there's so little communication inside Apple that you could have a bunch of podcasts where a bunch of people ramble on about how it seems like Apple's not listening to us or might live in a bubble and don't hear the things that we're saying. And that is not the case.
Maybe.
The Mac Pro Roundtable this past spring was one of the most straightforward, honest, and almost apologetic statements to the public Apple has ever really given. That was like the only time they've ever kind of done a mea culpa on like, yeah, this product we kind of messed up and we're going to fix it. I don't think we're going to get one of those for the problems of the current generation of MacBook Pro. But this is about as close as you can get. I think this statement to me says, like, you know, this was not some like off the cuff accidental thing that he let slip out. Like, I'm sure he thought about that before he said it and knew what he was saying. And I think this is as close as they're going to come to. There's been a lot of negative feedback about this generation of laptops, and we hear you.
Yeah, and we don't know what they're going to do about it. You know, it could be that what they do is still doesn't satisfy some people, doesn't satisfy others. But you can't say at this point that they have their heads in the sand, which is a thing that you could have said because they're so bad about giving any sort of transparency to their thinking. Because all you hear is like the earnings call and about how many of these things they're selling and how their profits are great, and it's like you have this fear that like maybe they think everything is awesome because they're selling more, like, and their customer sat is great and. You know, their average seller price is going up and they've sold more Macs than they ever sold before. Like, everything looks good. And you're like, and you worry that your concerns are irrelevant because who cares what you think about the keyboard? If tons of people are buying them, then you're wrong. And Apple should do what sells more Macs and makes more customers happy, right? And that is the fear of being marginalized. But to hear this direct feedback that, you know, and boy, do we hear like that. Not only do we, oh yeah, we hear some people have problems, but like the Johnny Ive in particular is probably getting an earful about like, you know, slimline keyboards that he insisted on or whatever. Who knows what the particular details are? But I like the idea of communicating to the public something that says we acknowledge you, and merely acknowledging doesn't mean we agree with you, doesn't mean. we're going to do what you want, but it does say we're not sticking our head in the sand and pretending you don't exist. And also that we're not disregarding you. Like they could have said, like what kind of what he said about Apple Park, which is another quote that I didn't pull from here, which is like, I don't understand when people complain about Apple Park, because essentially like, we didn't build it for you. You don't work for Apple. It's for people who work at Apple. And we know how people who work at Apple work and you don't. So stop complaining about our building. Like we're not building a house for you. That's a different kind of feedback, which is like, we hear you, but we think you are not, what is it? You don't have standing.
We hear you, but we don't care.
Yeah, you don't have standing. You're not a party in this conversation. Like, do you work at Apple? Then maybe we'll listen to you about how much you like the place where you have to work if you work at Apple. Or, you know, you don't have to because they're still on the old campus too. But anyway, but if you don't work at Apple, you can have your opinions, but we're not going to listen to it because we're building, you know, the place where Apple employees were. And obviously, I feel like if someone was more of an Apple nerd, they could have come back with Johnny and said, yeah, but Apple employees also have complaints about the spaceship. And so you could say, these aren't my complaints. I'm merely conveying to you the things that I've heard Apple employees tell me, you know, anonymously or otherwise about how they want to have private offices and blah, blah, blah. It's a separate thing. But clearly, Johnny was not ready to accept that feedback about Apple Park, but he seems ready to accept the feedback about the laptops. The question is, what happens next or what has already happened? Because as we talked about before, the timelines on hardware designs are long. And for all we know, 8 months ago, they already made a radical right turn about their keyboard plans for the next line of laptops. And we'll find out when they're released.
Here's hoping.
All right, Ask ATP, and we begin with Josh Keegan, who writes, I grew up a huge book reader. My wife did too. Combined, we have 3 or 4 bookcases full of paperbacks and hardcovers. I recently decided that we should get rid of them. They seem archaic to me now in the age of ebooks. My wife disagrees, and so they remain. Do you guys have a lot of books in the house? Does keeping paper books seem old-fashioned to you? Let me start by saying having us adjudicate your marital deliberations is probably not a wise choice. But that being said, Aaron and I are both pretty big readers. Aaron more so than me. I feel like I just don't have time for it, probably because I'm spending too much time on Twitter because I'm an idiot. But nevertheless, I do enjoy reading novels. I do quite like reading a physical book. If I can, I prefer a physical book over anything else, unless I'm traveling. But anyways, I don't see a problem with books. If you don't need the space for anything else, I don't know why you would get rid of them. But I am not one that is deeply bothered by I'm going to say clutter, although it doesn't sound like it's clutter since stuff. They're all contained in a book. Yes, stuff. Thank you. So I say my vote is keep them unless you have a reason for that space. But that's just me. Marco, what do you think?
We have some books. They're in a bookshelf in the living room. It's a nice big built-in thing, and it would look weird if it was empty. And so we keep a whole lot of books there. We don't actually really add or remove or use the books there very often. And so most of the books just sit there and look pretty, but that is a useful function. They look pretty on these giant shelves that are built into our house, and if they were gone, it would be weird. So, you know, like what you just said, Casey, like I don't see any problem with having them there. They're not causing any harm. They don't have any needs, really. And there's nothing else that we would put on those shelves at the moment. So if that ever changes, if we really need the space, or if for some reason we want to tear those shelves out of the walls, then sure, I would push to get rid of them then. But if they're not causing problems for you, I don't see why you'd get rid of them.
I like books. I've collected books since I was very young, not just for the words on the pages, but to the point where I would buy multiple copies of a book I liked because I like the books as objects, you know, special editions of books, leather-bound versions of books, books with fancy illustrations or shiny covers or really thick paper stock. I like books as objects, in addition to liking the words in them. When I went to work for what was at the time the largest ebook seller in the world, back in the early days before Amazon even got into the game, I got converted to ebooks pretty much wholesale. So I prefer to actually read books in electronic form, but I still have a huge soft spot for the physical books. I would do the things where I would buy the book and read it in ebook form, but then buy the first edition hardcover just to put on the shelf that I literally never opened. So I'm obviously very pro book. My problem is if you were like this and you really like books as physical objects and you're not fantastically wealthy, eventually you will run out of room to put books. Our house is essentially overflowing with books, with most bookshelves double and triple stacked with books in the attic. And so now I've mostly put a moratorium on buying more paper books because I don't want to displace any books that I have. So right now I mostly only buy very large, beautiful coffee table books filled with illustrations, or like those really gigantic, awesome making of Star Wars books that have lots of words and illustrations in them that would be difficult to do in electronic form unless someone gives me my 27-inch iPad Pro. So I am all for physical books, but like so many physical objects, if you continue down that path, you will probably eventually run out of room for books.
Craig writes, why does Apple refuse to make desktop backlit keyboards? Gaming keyboards go crazy with neon lights. Do you think Apple would ever make a desktop keyboard with just enough light to see your keys? I have a hard time answering this question because I can touch type and I have been able to for a very long time. So this having lights on my keyboard does not really help me. I presume that they don't really have any interest in this because it would, you know, cause the battery on your Magic Keyboard to drain even faster. And yes, I know it's easily rechargeable. You don't have to harpoon a turtle to do it. But nevertheless, you know, it's nice not having to plug my keyboard in but once every month or two. And so I don't think they will personally, but I don't know. That's my two cents. Mark, we went to you first last time. So, John, what do you think?
Even if you touch type, like the reason they have the light up keyboards and laptop is they think people will be using them in dark places. And yeah, you can touch type, but can you touch type the media keys? Can you touch type the function keys? Most people can't. Like, it's just too far of a reach and they're just too weird. And you occasionally have to glance and see, you know, where is, you know, F7 or where is the pause key or, you know, or whatever.
I mean, hell, with these new keyboards, you can't even touch type the arrow keys.
Yeah, well, you can eventually if you feel for the little divider and the two halvesy keys for top and bottom before you go to the left or right. But anyway, it's annoying. So I think there is a place for backlighting on keyboards, even for touch typists. But for desktop keyboards, if you're using a desktop keyboard in a dark place, that's kind of your choice, probably. Like, it's not like a laptop where you may find yourself on a plane where everybody's sleeping or, you know, in an environment where the lighting is not ideal. And like Casey said, you do have the charging difficulty. So I don't think Apple is opposed to backlit keyboards. I wouldn't expect any neon ones. I feel like it's a thing I can see Apple shipping if they could sort out the battery issues. They would probably ship it, you know, just because someone will get it in an idea that it's a useful thing to have, and they can charge a little bit more money for the backlit version. They would do it, but honestly, unless someone inside Apple is really passionate about this, I just see them leaving it as a third-party opportunity, as they say. Because if they haven't come out with one by now, they obviously don't think it's a big need.
You know, using PC gaming keyboards that are full of LEDs as an example is not a good example of why Apple should do this. Because those things are hideous. And I think if Apple knows those exist, which I kind of hope that no one there knows, but if they do know, they would use that as an argument why not to make these things. But yeah, also, as you mentioned, it would have to be charged significantly more frequently. Also, I think that the need for it is less on desktops because desktop screens are so much bigger and you keep them so much brighter usually because there's no battery concern, that there's a pretty good chance just the light from the screen lights up the keys enough to show you where the keys are, even in a pitch dark room. So I think the need for it is significantly lower. It does, however, just look cool. Like when it's done right, like the way Apple's are done with subtle white lighting as opposed to blue LEDs, when done tastefully like that, it can look really cool. It just looks like a nice luxury product, like on the laptops. This isn't to say that they should never do it, but I don't think they will just because, again, the charging needs, the less actual like physical need for it because you can see your keyboard usually more like in desktops. And also that, you know, the desktop keyboards are just a pretty low priority for Apple. They don't really redesign them that often or put that much effort into them. So I even, you know, from that point of view, I think it would be very hard to argue that Apple should, you know, put in the effort to make that happen on a hardware line that they update, what, every 10 years?
All right. And finally, Pradan Statev writes, how does dynamic ad targeting in podcasts work? Ad companies say they can target listeners, but Marco has said that you can only really know how many downloads the MP3 podcast file gets. And that's about it when it comes to data, say for proprietary apps. And then he added, this one is for Casey. I'm not sure why, because I feel like I am deeply ill-equipped to answer this question. But this sounds like it's two different things to me all rolled into one, or maybe I just would like someone, Marco, I guess, to clarify. So when I hear dynamic and podcasts, what I think is there are podcasts, I don't know, servers, for lack of a better description, or networks where they know that an ad starts at 10 minutes and it is 2 minutes long. And they can run an ad in that spot for a week or two and then change that ad to be something else. And they'll re-encode, or I'm assuming re-encode the MP3. And for 2 weeks, it'll be the next ad, and then so on and so forth. But what Prodan is talking about is different than that, if I'm not mistaken, which is, oh, Casey is a white male that is in his mid-30s. Let's give him these ads as opposed to different ones. So, Marco, can you kind of tell me what this is all about?
Yeah, the latter theory you have is the more correct one. So the reason this came up, and the reason I put it in here as a question I wanted to answer, is that a lot of people are starting to hear what are pretty clearly like dynamically on-demand inserted ads in usually popular podcasts. This past year, there have been a lot of major podcasts, like from major producers, like some of the public radio producers and some of the big networks. Major producers are now frequently using dynamic ad insertion. And what this is new ads can be inserted on every download, on every request that the file gets, every download request from a client or a web browser can have different ads in it. They don't do it by re-encoding, they do it by splicing, because the MP3 file format is very, very easy to splice, which might lead into a future topic if we ever get to it. So basically what they do is, your download request from your podcast player or your web browser hits their basically ad splicing server, and based on your IP address and anything it can glean from your headers, which fortunately for a podcast app is pretty minimal, but it can at least tell usually which podcast app you're using, what kind of device and what OS version it has, and from your IP address, it can derive your approximate location. Now, if it's a big ad network, and if it's integrated with web ads, then they can also derive other things that a web browser can pick up. And they can correlate that data based on your IP address and maybe some idea of what your phone model is. They can then correlate that with other data they have from other sources, like maybe Facebook or Twitter or other big ad networks, and they can figure out more about you. But all the podcast app is providing is whatever they would get if you fetched, say, an image off their servers, which is your IP address and a user agent header. That's it. But that is enough that a lot of people report hearing like an ad for a local car dealership in the middle of a podcast from a national provider. And that creeps people out, and they wonder what's going on. A lot of times they blame Overcast, or they ask me, like, hey, what's this? How did this work? But yeah, this is just these big publishers are now very, very frequently using these dynamic ad insertion platforms. And the way it works is pretty simple. As I said, they derive whatever they can from your IP address and the user agent header, and then they throw in an ad. And MP3 is a very forgiving and simple format. It's very, very easy to take chunks out of and splice in. So in their CMSs, when they produce the shows, they just say, you can put an ad at these two timestamps in the show. The main problem I have with it as a listener, first of all, is that it's kind of creepy, and the ads are oftentimes pretty low-value ads because they're things like car dealerships, and it just turns into basically what radio ads were, which is not something any of us should ever ascribe or aspire to, because they're really, bargain basement, low-price, low-value ads. So hopefully that's not the world we're heading towards here. But also, it causes other problems. So for instance, the MP3 file format specifies length in about three different ways. And a lot of times these splicing ad platforms don't update them all correctly. So it causes weird problems in players like mine, where sometimes certain files will say end 2 minutes early, because that's the amount of ad they injected and they forgot to update the duration, or their platform didn't do it right, or something like that. Or seeking will be slightly broken, or something like that. The other major problem is, even if you get past the technical hurdles there, because the ads they insert are not consistent lengths, it starts to erode the value of timestamp links. So you can't, for instance, say, oh, you got to hear this NPR podcast at 17 minutes. Because the 17 minutes when you download the file might be a different part of the file than what the person who's telling you that had in their copy of the file. Because if you had 10 minutes of ads in yours and they had 7 minutes of ads in theirs, you're going to be 3 minutes off. So it erodes the value of sharing timestamps and of referring to timestamps, which I think is very damaging to the spread of podcasts. But ultimately, I don't have any real say in this. They're going to do what they're going to do. They are doing it. And I've tried to argue with some of these producers they shouldn't be doing this, but they are anyway. So, oh well, this is the world we live in now. And that's how it works. It's pretty basic. And I wish it didn't work that way, but it does. The good thing is that it can't ever get as bad as web tracking. You know, when you fetch a web page, your browser executes code on that page's behalf if that has any JavaScript embedded, which these days it always does. So the amount of data that a web page can collect about you is way higher than the amount of data that a podcast publisher can collect about you, because when your podcast app downloads the file, it's just playing a media file. It is not executing arbitrary code supplied by the publisher. So they can't add any more tracking or collect any more data or observe your behavior any more than a person at this IP address and using this app downloaded this file. That's it. That's all the information they have. Again, they can correlate that if they know more about that IP address from other sources. But as far as the podcast player is concerned, that's all it's giving them.
But the scary thing, though, is, and I think that people don't think about, is that they do have a source for correlation. They know so much about your IP address because chances are very good that in the recent past you have hit a web page somewhere that had some Facebook embedded widget that got your Facebook cookies, that now knows who you are on Facebook, that now knows your entire social graph and your first and last name and the last thing you bought from Amazon. And like those ad networks, that's all they're doing is correlating a user activity across multiple platforms and just synthesizing it into this, you know, up-to-date knowledge about a particular person or IP address or combination of IP address and user agent and whatever else they can glean from your device. Like that's all these networks do. And so even though the podcast player is not revealing the minimum it possibly can about you, once they go off to the side and look up all the other stuff, that's how they know, like, that you're shopping for toilets. And now it's time to show you a toilet. They know where you live. They know who your friends are. They know you've been shopping for toilets and they're going to insert a toilet ad. And that seems terrifying. But it's because of all the rest of the internet, particularly the web, not because of the podcast player. And that's why these things are creepy, the idea that they aggregate and centralize this knowledge so that there's almost nothing you can do on the internet where they can't figure out who you are through those kinds of correlations. So, you know, I don't know what the solution is, but the relative purity of podcasts doesn't actually save us from anything. And even for stuff like show notes, if you can put HTML in show notes, it's only a matter of time before one or more podcast applications pre-render the show notes and are not as scrupulous as Overcast about allowing what appears in that HTML and just sort of take the easy way out and just throw some content from a feed into a web view, and that executes and it has a little tracking blip and embeds a Facebook widget and runs JavaScript and who knows what else. Like, so the web has a way of seeping into many different corners of applications, and if you're not constantly fighting against that tide, it's really easy for creepy stuff to sneak into your application.
We are sponsored this week by Linode, my favorite web host. Go to linode.com/ATP to learn more and use code accidentalpodcast10 to get a $10 credit. Linode is the best web host I have ever used. I have, trust me, a lot of experience with hosted web servers going all the way back to the year 2000. And I've hosted literally hundreds of servers and VPSs since then at probably 10 or 15 different web hosts. And Linode just kicks their butts. It's so much better on so many levels. That's why I move everything there now. It is just so much more pleasant to use. Their pricing is incredibly compelling. Plans start at just $10 a month. Linode now offers 2 gigs of RAM at that $10 a month level. This is pretty much unheard of in the web hosting industry. The resources you get for $10 a month at Linode, I used to pay hundreds of dollars a month for not that long ago. And they have all sorts of great features. They have managed backups. They have managed load balancers, which I use. They're wonderful. They have managed stats if you want that. They have both managed and unmanaged services for your actual Linodes themselves. So if you need help, it's available to you, but it's mostly made for unmanaged people who want to run it yourself. And they have all sorts of great documentation and tutorials to learn how to run a Linux server if you have any questions. In fact, chances are, if you've ever Googled for some kind of answer on how to run a Linux server, you've probably come across their help documentation, even if you weren't using Linode, because that's how good it is, that it ranks highly in the search engines because people keep using it. Linode stuff is so great. It's so easy to use. $10 a month gets you 2 gigs of RAM in a virtual server. You have full root access. You can install whatever you want. It's wonderful. So check out Linode today. I highly recommend it. It is the only web host you should be looking at if what you're looking for is straight up web hosting. Go to linode.com/ATP and use promo code accidentalpodcast10 to get a $10 credit. Thank you so much to Linode for hosting all of my stuff and supporting this show.
Thursday night, I'm laying in bed and I'm looking at, you know, Twitter or what have you, and I'm starting to see that people in the future are very perturbed. And they're perturbed because apparently some of their phones are endlessly rebooting. And I'm starting to see like text messages or Slack messages from friends who live in the future. And they're saying, oh my God, something is deeply wrong. Change your phone's clock. What? Change your phone's clock, because once you hit Friday night, it doesn't matter, one of these days, once you hit overnight at like 12:15, suddenly your phone will go bananas. I think it was Friday night into Saturday. That's my bad.
Yeah, it was into December 2nd.
Yep. So change your phone, Casey. Either turn off all notifications, which there is no big red, you know, abort switch for notifications, so you'd have to go into every single app and turn them off, or change your clock such that you will never roll over the very early morning of December 2nd, which is what I did. And that causes a whole new world of problems that are not terribly interesting, but it was a pain in the butt.
That was my first question I was going to ask you when I was living backwards in time, going through your old Twitter past and seeing that you and lots of other people, not just you, went with that option. Like, something's wrong. Mm-hmm. We're not quite sure what it is at this point in time, but one of the suggested solutions is to set your clock back. And a bunch of people who I felt like should know better said, I'll do that. I'll set my clock back.
Whoa, slow down. What are my options? So I have three options to my mind. I can wait and see and potentially end up with a phone that is not bricked, but is damn near useless. I can pray that I don't get zapped by this bug. Or I can set my clock back and just deal with some inconveniences.
Yep, and both of those two options are better than setting your clock back. Like, in general, I would say, like, as a computer user rule of thumb, this didn't used to be true, but has been true for the past, I don't know, decade or so.
Since SSL?
Yeah, probably. But even, actually, maybe even before that, don't change the date on your computer, because unbeknownst to you, tons of things on your computer and especially on your phone don't work if your date is not the real date. Things like iMessage, which you probably care about a lot, like texting is a fairly popular application on phones
worked.
These days.
It was very weird, SSL, but it worked.
All those things, they're not saying they will instantly break, but they can break. Websites, popular websites that you use, applications that, like, many, many things depend on the date. So, like, the options you listed, like, you could cross your fingers and hope. You could wait for a different thing. Another one is you could just shut down your phone and wait with your phone turned off. So at the very least, you know, like, whatever data is on your phone is safe because the thing is off, right? And then just find out what the desk is going to sell. But you know for a fact that changing the date is going to mess some things up. Maybe a few things, maybe a lot of things. And the main reason I wouldn't change it in this case is in a sort of an unknown type scenario where you don't know what the deal is. Like, is this a big bug? Is it a little bug? What's the fix going to be? Is Apple going to have a thing? There's so many unknowns. I wouldn't want to add to the noise with date stuff. And this happened with a lot of people who would set their date back, where once the bug fix was out, they're like, oh, it fixed the bug, but now I can't FaceTime with people. And it was because they had set the date back. And now they're
Face ID,
whatever it was, yeah. And now they're suffering from the fallout of their attempted fix. So it's counterintuitive if you haven't dealt with any of these things, but perhaps surprisingly, changing the data on your computer or phone can and will cause all sorts of weird problems that are difficult to attribute or diagnose and won't give you nice error messages that say, oh, you changed your date. So I would suggest that if that, among all the options that you have, pick that one last, pick that one after, you know, prefer the option of simply turning off your phone. So
I disagree.
I'd also add to the list of problems that it causes possible sync bugs and possible data loss with apps that sync.
Yes,
because
yes.
A lot of sync engines try to resolve merges, changes, and conflicts using time. this isn't always the best approach, but this is basically how a lot of them do it anyway. So
sometimes that's all you got, depending on how the sync service works.
Right, and there's all sorts of methods to sync, but using time to help resolve like who changed what last and whose version of this should be the authoritative version is a very, very common way to do it. So if you change your date back, not only are you likely to, not only are you causing a whole bunch of other weird stuff to happen, for instance, like you've now created like two copies of December 1st in your computing environment. And like, so like things can be written to the file system, or things can be changed, or things can be dated in a way that makes them seem like they were sequential in one direction, but they were actually sequential in the other direction. There's so many weird things that can happen. This doesn't usually happen with daylight saving time bugs because A, that doesn't actually change the underlying Unix time value of the computer, and B, you're normally asleep between 2 and 3 in the morning, so it doesn't usually affect you, and because you're not usually using a computer at that point. But changing your clock back by a whole day gives you a large opportunity to make a whole bunch of changes and create data and make edits to things and things like that in a way that will very much confuse software and cause weird bugs to happen that you might not immediately see.
See, and I understand that, but I think two different comments in the chat room kind of sum up my opinion. Psycho Machead said, tons of things not working is better than everything not working, and I agree with that, because you guys aren't wrong. You're absolutely right, but I didn't know at the time, and I knew I was about to go to sleep for the evening and cross into this no man's land. I didn't know at the time how bad the error was. Like, I heard it was just a constant respring, but I didn't know if it was a constant respring every 2 seconds, every 2 minutes, every 2 hours. And I wanted to leave myself the ability to say, I don't know, do a software update without having to worry about the respring happening every 2 seconds. Now, as it turns out, it was not every 2 seconds. It was every like 2 or 3 minutes, but I didn't know at the time, and I knew I was about to go to sleep.
But like Marco said, data loss, like turning your phone off is still the preferable one, like until the dust settles, because if you had a sync engine that now thinks the server side version is newer than your day old data, which is actually updated a second ago, and it overwrites your locally edited information with stuff from the server, like you haven't actually done anything, but you merely changed the date back, so it's confused about what the latest stuff is, and it brings that, like, you could have data loss. Whereas, you know, the respring thing, or even just the restarting, there was not a mention of data loss in that. And either way, if you want to avoid it entirely, turn your phone off, shut it down, and wait to find out what the deal is. That is the safest possible default. And I'm not saying, like, you know, setting back that it's not the end of the world. Like, it's you made a call, and you probably knew the risks better than most people. This is mostly for other people who think that changing the date has no risks associated with it, to emphasize that it has lots of risks, and the fallout from it can ripple through for a long time and can be hard to distinguish problems caused by you changing the date and problems caused by the bug and problems that still linger after the bug is fixed. And like I said, I think that happened. People who changed the date had problems when they tried to apply the software update because they had changed the date.
See, but the thing is, though, we didn't know, or at least I didn't know at the time I made this decision, what was going to happen. And I don't think just turning off my phone and waiting to the next day and trying on another device to see what the fix was, that to me is not a valid option. Because what if, for the sake of discussion, it was a respring every 2 seconds? How am I going to accomplish anything at that point? So my phone goes off and everything's working. Like, by that, I mean, I turn it off Friday night, everything's working. Saturday morning, I wake up and I turn it on, immediately resprings. Now what do I do?
Well, you don't turn on the phone until you know there's a fix, like, or until you know what the situation is. Because like information came out, like we don't know now, but presumably by the next day you'd wake up and you'd read, here's what the deal is. Is there a fix? Is there not a fix? How bad is the bug? What are the possible workarounds? It was like, you know, like waiting for more information to come out, essentially, because more information did come out in about a day. You learn the shape of this bug. You learn what it actually caused. You learn multiple workarounds, including the date thing. And by then, people were learning about the problems about having the date bug. Like, I'm just saying, like, patience, right? And, you know, no, your phone's not going to fix itself when it's turned off, but it's also not going to get worse. So, like, presumably, Apple will fix this. Apple's not going to allow this. If it's an important bug, it's not like Apple's going to be silent for 6 months about this bug and no one can turn on their phones. Like, you're not going to be stuck with a turned off phone forever. There will be a fix. And the more serious it is, the sooner the fix will be. So I'm saying it's like that is the, it's perhaps the most annoying option, but is also the most conservative and probably the safest. And that's why I would rank it above changing the date, because that is, that's more of a risky option. It's a way like, can I continue, can I do something that will expose me to a small amount of risk, but let me not have to, let me continue to use my phone essentially.
Yeah, that's exactly the math I did. And to me, being able to still use my phone was worth that risk. And I'm not saying that I'm right. I'm just saying I stand by the decision I made at the time. But anyway, as it turns out, it was not as dire as I thought. And to be honest, John's approach in retrospect was the best answer, which would have been to turn off your phone, just wait it out, see what happens. And as I think I said a moment ago, it turns out that I guess something with local notifications was causing an error within Springboard. And Springboard is, you know, the home screen, among other things. And so Springboard would crash every 2 or 3 minutes. And this was only if you had an app that used a local notification. And if you're not an iOS developer, that may not mean a lot to you. And so a local notification to a user looks identical in almost every scenario, every scenario I can think of, to a push notification. But the difference is, rather than coming from an external to your device server, it's coming from your phone itself. So your phone is either saying, maybe in a background process, oh, I would like to send a, you know, have a notification show up. Or perhaps in the case of like DUE, hey, this person has asked for a reminder about this thing they want to do at, you know, 9 o'clock in the evening. The person has asked to be reminded that ATP is being recorded. And so they'll schedule a reminder locally on the device for 9 o'clock on a Wednesday evening. And those were the things that were causing the problem. And by the time I woke up, there was actually a fix available. And before we talk about what that fix was, do we have any other commentary about the bug itself?
Yeah, I do.
Before you get to Marco's commentary, the best solution, obviously, is always luck, which is what I had going for me that day, because I was way behind in Twitter. So like I said, I'm reading about the bug like hours and hours, like I'm reading hours and hours old tweets. So the whole rest of the world knows how it turns out already, but I don't know. I'm reading, you know, 5 hours ago tweets, right? And I'm like, oh, look at this bug, and I'm rolling through. And so I'm learning about it in real time on my phone. All the while, I'm like, I can't wait to see how this turns out. Is it going to turn out that my phone is affected by it? And I'm like, well, it's not rebooting to Springboard constantly, right?
You won't believe what happens next.
Yeah, right. So basically, I lucked out because I guess I don't have any applications that do local notifications. So I got to read the story of my present, backwards in time. And that was fun. And so, yeah, if you can rely on luck, I highly recommend it.
My solution was to be a member of multiple Slack groups where Casey was also a member, because on the night of December 1st, when this was all coming out, like right before midnight that it was going to start happening, Casey posted in every Slack that he was in about this horrible thing.
I was very nervous.
Yeah, I read his Slack things backwards in time too. I'm like, oh wow, Casey really went all out warning the world about this bug.
Well, because again, at the time, like, I didn't have a whole lot of facts, but what I did know was that people in the future, and by that I mean in like Australia and New Zealand, were having serious problems with their phones. And so these are all, like, especially in the Slacks, you know, I didn't really sound the alarm too heavily on Twitter, but for my friends in Slack, I want you guys to be able to react and do something about this. Be that turn off your phone, be it set your clocks, whatever the case may be, because the initial reports, of course, because it was a game of telephone, was, oh my God, your phone is going to explode if you cross, I think it was 12:15 on Saturday morning. And so, yes, I was spamming everyone, but I stand by that as well, because I would much rather, you know, roles reversed, I would much rather see Marco or John spam me in 2 or 3 different Slacks and say, oh God, set your clock back, and at least be or make a decision, you know, what I want to do, rather than have Marco or John be like, eh, I'm sure it's fine.
Well, and I appreciate it, because that's how I heard about it. Because, like, so, I had, like, a night, like, I think, I forgot what I was doing that night, but I was, like, you know, spending time with family, so I wasn't browsing the internet, I wasn't on Twitter that night, and as I mentioned in previous episodes, I don't have Twitter on my phone anymore, so I don't browse Twitter on my phone. So I was getting ready, I was brushing my teeth and reading my phone, because I'm a hopeless technology addict, and I read my phone while I brush my teeth.
Yep.
Right? You got to hold the toothbrush like straight down so Face ID will recognize you when you first open it up. Anyway, how else are you going to spend 2 minutes thinking? No. So I'm brushing my teeth and I started seeing all these messages from you, and I started thinking, and by that time, we had known by that point, this was like 4 minutes before midnight, but we knew at that point that it had to do with recurring local notifications only. So as I'm sitting there brushing my teeth, I'm like, oh my God, wait, okay. You know, quick inventory of like household devices. What's going to be a problem? Like, all right, all my stuff's on the beta, so I'm fine. Tiff, oh no, her stuff is not on the beta. And I'm thinking like, what's the fastest way I can solve this problem in the next 4 minutes? Meanwhile, Tiff's trying to like read her phone in bed, like, you know, read Instagram and like go to sleep. And I rush in, I run into
grab
the bedroom.
It out of her hand.
I run into the bedroom with the toothbrush in my mouth. I'm like, Tiff, uninstall your water reminder app sometime in the next 4 minutes. She's like, what? Why? Like, just do it. Just, what? She's like freaking like, why? Because she could tell I was super freaked out about it. She had no idea what the hell I was talking about. Because I realized that like I was thinking through the what she would have on her phone that would send recurring local notifications. She had some kind of like drink more water reminding application. So I knew that was a thing. And I finished brushing my teeth, you know, ran back in, like, had like 2 minutes left. Are there any other apps that you have on your phone that send you notifications that are not from a big company? Because the thing is, like, every other app from a big company is going to send remote push notifications. They're never going to use local. They're only going to ever use remote. The only apps that really ever use local notifications at all are apps that really need to for some reason, like, you know, reminding apps or alarm apps or to-do apps or Overcast, for that's an implementation detail. And so, you know, I knew because it was recurring local notifications, like, that cuts out a lot of potential app types. Like, very few apps use recurring local notifications. So that's why this was a huge problem. It was a huge problem only for people who use a relatively small subset of app types. So this was actually not nearly as bad as it could have been. I mean, if this was a problem with anybody who had any kind of notifications, that would have been a much bigger problem than it was. And it was pretty big, but it could have been way worse. So she got off okay after installing the water reminder app. Because I was even thinking, like, can I install a beta in 4 minutes? Nope. That's not gonna be fast enough. Didn't have the profile installed, it's not gonna work. Like, yeah. So anyway, how did Apple solve this problem, Casey?
So as it turns out, and we've kind of put these pieces, not the three of us, just in general, the communities put these pieces together after the fact. As it turns out, iOS 11.2 is due to come out this week. And I have heard conflicting reports what day of the week it was supposed to come out. And it doesn't really matter, to be honest. But
it probably wasn't Friday night at midnight.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, 11.2 was in the hopper, so to speak, and it was imminently going to be released. And so one would assume that it had been heavily QA'd, it was pretty much ready to go, and they were just waiting to make sure that their servers were, you know, up to snuff, that you know, the emergency response team was there and ready to act, you know, when they hit the go button or whatever it is that Apple does when they release a new, you know, iOS point release. And so if you think about it, Apple had a couple of choices, right? They can
I'm kind of imagining like Johnny Ive in a totally white room with a big white button on a perfectly formed wooden Apple Store table.
Go. It wouldn't even be labeled, though.
I know, he hates buttons. It would just be a spot on the table.
Yeah, exactly.
That he would have to just apply some pressure to, and it would be a force click button.
He just gives it a meaningful look. He doesn't have to touch it.
But anyway, the point is that, that, you know, Apple, all kidding aside, had basically two choices. They could either put together a fix just for this issue and try to like emergency QA test it and try to put together an emergency patch and start shipping this patch. Or it was very quickly obvious that people on the beta were not having this problem, like Marco had said. And so they could alternatively just say, you know what, the hell with it. 11.2 wasn't supposed to go out, like Marco said, at midnight Eastern on a Friday evening. And gosh knows that if you've ever done anything with software, you never want to deploy on a Friday night, because that means you're really on a Friday at all, because that means your weekend is all but assuredly screwed. But at this point, they were screwed anyway, so why not? And what they ended up doing was releasing 11.2 early, which I think was a smart choice. I mean, it's easy for me to armchair quarterback, but hey, that's what we do. To me, I think that was the best choice they could have made, but it certainly had its own set of penalties, in no small part because, say, you know, the release notes, for example, if I'm not mistaken, mentioned Apple. What is it? Apple Pay Cash? Is that what it's called? Basically, peer-to-peer Apple Pay.
Apple Venmo.
Apple Venmo / Apple Square Cash. Well, anyways, so that was mentioned in the release notes, and then all of us, including me, went to go find it, and it wasn't there, and we were like, well, what's going on here? And as it turns out, there was a server-side switch they needed to flip, which I think they did Monday, or it was early this week, regardless. But, you know, it was clear that this was not their intention, but given the hand they had in front of them, I think this was the best decision they could have made. I mean, Marco, would you say that you would do the same thing in their shoes?
I mean, I don't really have enough information to know what their options really were here, but probably. I mean, I was using the 11.2 beta for a while, and it seemed fine to me. But that's just one person. If it was truly just like a couple of days from release, then yeah, that seems like a totally fine solution. The problem is embarrassing. The fact that they keep having problems with iPhones related to date and time is concerning. For things like, you know, alarms not going off in certain days for people and weird daylight savings bugs, I am definitely concerned at the number of bugs that iOS specifically has about local date and time issues. I thought we were done with those a few years ago, and apparently we're not. And that, I think, could use some investigation on Apple's part, maybe some auditing and some, you know, really making sure that code is solid, because we shouldn't be having those kinds of bugs in 2017. You know, Apple's better than that. But as for the actual fix they did to fix this horribly embarrassing bug, yeah, it seems fine.
You know, and I should also mention, there was something going on with macOS as well, and I never really got a clear read on what it was. But like,
have you guys heard that month 13 is out of bounds?
Well, I have heard that.
Have you heard the good news about month 13?
Tell me again why I should update to High Sierra. This
month 13, is it in bounds or is it out of bounds? I forget.
You'll never know. No, but it wasn't even the month 13 thing. There's something to do with like Spotlight, I think, or something like that. I forget exactly what it was, but there was a not widespread, but medium spread. I don't even know if that's really a phrase, but a medium spread bug that was affecting, I believe, High Sierra as well. And I can't remember what the hell it was, but it was something to do with like your menu bar or Spotlight or something like that.
I haven't seen that one. I'm afraid to look at my console for the month 13 messages, but the month 13 one is still going on, isn't it?
Did 10 point whatever point 2 fix it?
I looked at the release notes for it briefly, and I thought the very first item would be month 13 is now no longer out of bounds.
We've added a new month 13 to the calendar to fix this bug.
Yeah, people aren't so far as to find like the code in Core Foundation that runs this assertion that is printing this message. And like, I know, and in the grand scheme of all things we've talked about with the you know, Springboard crashing repeatedly, and you know, whatever the problem was last week that I've already forgotten, like, month 13 being out of bounds, which, to be clear, what we're talking about is a message that appears in the console on your Mac that repeatedly tells you that month 13 is out of bounds.
Like multiple times per second, like slowing down your Mac.
Yeah, it depends on where it's coming from, what applications you have running. But it sounds like, you know, well, whatever, your Mac still works. You just got a bunch of noise in the console. Not a big deal. But something about the sort of, you know, the hygienic programmer in me finds that one all the more bothersome because it hasn't been fixed, and sort of knowing that your computer is emitting 10 or 20 of this identical log message per second, every second, every day that you're using it, and Apple hasn't fixed it, kind of like gnaws at the back of my mind. Like it doesn't sit well with me. Regardless of the actual implications, like, well, they use a database format and it coalesces duplicates, and really it's just incrementing a counter and you're not actually storing duplicates and blah, 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 like whatever. I don't care about the technical things. Like, it's just, you know, and maybe also as a server-side programmer, noise in logs is bad. Noise in logs prevent you from seeing signal. Stop spewing stuff to logs. Like, it's the thing that makes you go around the company with the big virtual stick and bop people on the head and say, stop filling the logs with crap. If you're debugging, fine, debug and then turn off your log messages. Like, keep the logs clean. So I really hope that month 13 will no longer be out of bounds.
Yeah, that's the one big thing. Like, that when they introduced this new logging framework, I think it was, what, last year or the year before, when they introduced the new logging framework, like, they touted, like, oh, it's so lightweight, you can just leave, you know, incredibly verbose logging enabled all the time, and the system will handle it because, like, oh, it's so efficient, and like, mm-hmm, if no one's looking at the log, it doesn't get written anywhere or something like that. Like, there's all sorts of details that make it super efficient. But like, yeah, I'm with you. Like, first of all, looking at console or even the Xcode developer log is nearly useless since this change, because the apparent message within Apple when they did this was, now that we've made logging really cheap, we can just dump diarrhea in the logs constantly from everything. And it makes it really hard to actually look at the logs when you're having a problem and find anything useful at all, or to run anything on a tethered device with Xcode. And even if you do the whole, like, you know, OS, whatever, OS disable mode, disable, whatever that macro is you're supposed to set, it doesn't actually work. It doesn't actually do what you want. And it's just like, every part of iOS and macOS now just dumps so much crap to the log that it has made the log useless. And not only for developers, but also just for users. Like, sometimes some forum answer will be like, hey, go look at console.app for something like this, and that might tell us an answer. I really strongly disagree with the Apple, you know, way of doing this now, where logging tons of unnecessary crap all the time is considered okay because they made logs really cheap.
Yeah, and for the developers, like, I think it's actually more reasonable to say, oh, just whitelist your application, like, use our filtering features to just see logs from your applications. But for users, like, console has historically been, granted, one of the last resorts, but, like, when you're really desperate to see what the deal is, you will probably find yourself launching console and saying, maybe there's a message in console that will let me know what the problem is. And in that case, you can't run any filters because you don't know what you want to filter. You don't know what application or what part of the system. You don't know what to filter for. You can't whitelist. You could selectively blacklist if you had eliminated sources of things, but, like, sort of an overview of, like, hey, is anything weird going on in my system? That's why in server-side applications, the general best practice is to not have noisy log, to have at least one log that is basically, when everything's okay, the log is relatively quiet, or there's only one kind of log message there, or, like, some way where you can say, look, if anything other than this normal state appears here, we have a problem. And the normal state may be total quiet, so which would mean that every single line to this log means there's a problem. Or the normal state could mean log messages of this type are fine, but if you see any other kind of log message, that's an indicative of a problem. That's what you need. If you just have a big dumping ground, no matter how good your filtering facilities are, no matter how good you are keeping up your whitelist or blacklist of filtering, it's very difficult to, especially in the case of an emergency, you have no place to look anymore where a human being can look at it and say, does that look normal to you? It's like, I don't know. It's just a bunch of crap. Is it more crap or less crap than we were before? And then finally, like, month 13 is out of bounds. It represents some kind of error. Is it a programming error? Is it a data error? Whatever the source of the error is an assertion that it's failing. And we all agree that there is no month 13 in the calendar that we all use. So something somewhere is wrong. So someone should fix it. So we don't have to see that message 20 times a second.
Should this be a log message? Shouldn't this be an assertion? Shouldn't it crash? Like, that's... By the way, also, for the record, I have 10.13.2 on my laptop. I just booted it up. I'm still getting month 13 is out of bounds errors in the console. So 10.13.2 does not fix this bug. It also doesn't fix my font smoothing bug, because the unchecking the use font smoothing when available box still is completely broken. Now, what, 3 months after the release of this OS, two major point releases in, if you have that box off, everything is still completely broken. So thanks, Apple. Why am I being pushed so hard to use this OS? Why is this being pushed forcibly through my app store? Like, promote it when it's ready. It's not ready. Sorry.
Anyway, the month 13 thing, I don't think crashing is probably appropriate, because if it's a data-driven error, the data is bad, the code is not, and the code is just telling you that the data is bad, and in a verbose way, in the tradition that you just said of, like, oh, if you find something wrong and you're not going to throw an exception, just log it so you'll know about it. But if it happens 20 times a second, it's not great. So I'm assuming this is some sort of data bug where some piece of data somewhere, either from the network or on the system, has a bad date in it, or some bad date math added 1 to a 12 and got a 13. Not a reason for the code in question to throw an exception in that case, because it could be inside some important subsystem that doesn't want to, like, take down the whole system just because it got some bad data or whatever. I'm just saying, find where the bug is and fix it. And obviously it is less urgent than everything else we've talked about, but, you know, irrationally, like I said, hygiene wise, for me, it feels mentally urgent to me that this stop being on in the console.
So, not a good week for Apple last week. Between the root bug and this bug, it's just not good.
But not actually, I'm going to say not, you know, so it's not good, lots of bugs, but not actually that bad either. Because in the grand scheme of things, Apple, like, either through luck, partially through luck, but also partially through things working the ways they're supposed to, Apple got fixes out in a timely manner. The fixes more or less work, plus or minus some minor fixes to the fixes. The user base in general, you know, could have been much worse, but it wasn't. I mean, the reasons Marco said, local notifications only, the fact that the fixes came out pretty quickly. I'm not sure if any of these things even made it out of the little tech nerd circle onto, like, the evening news or whatever, into the wider world. Like, was there a front page New York Times story about everybody's iPhones bricking? Like, that would be worse, right? So it was unfortunate, and there was definitely some bad luck involved, but there was also some good luck. And I think Apple more or less functioned the way it's supposed to. Oh, you've got an emergency and a bug, all hands on deck. Let's fix the problem. And they fixed it. So, you know, you can get pessimistic about the fact that there's all these bugs, and we've talked about that at length, but I'm mostly satisfied that Apple handled the situation the way you would expect a professional, good organization to handle the situation.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, they're not, like, as angry as I am about how crappy they're treating High Sierra right now, and how it should not have been released, period. Like, this OS is still a beta, and should not have been released. And if they insisted on releasing it, they should not be promoting it as hard as they are. They should not be automatically prompting people to install it as much as they are. But all that being said, they are making software. Bugs happen. They are fixing them. You know, bugs happen on both platforms now. Like, this isn't just a Mac thing. Like, iOS has problems. Mac has problems. As long as they fix the problems, they're doing their job. Yeah, but High Sierra is not ready.
I mean, I don't know why you say that. I have it on every one of my machines, and it's been fine.
It's just very upset about font smoothing.
Apparently.
Well, and root and month 13, like, this, it's not that it has one problem. High Sierra has lots of problems.
I don't know. I mean, it depends on if you encounter the problems. Like, the example is, I had all these trepidations about installing it, right? And then eventually I just did install it on my wife's computer, and it's been fine. I mean, I'm sure her console is filling right now with month 13 being out of bounds. But beyond that, it's more or less works. It's hard for me to gauge, like, what is the stability of this thing across the entire user base. Some people have more problems with it than others. None of us have the Windows Server crashing bug, which would certainly be something that would make us all screaming that we shouldn't have upgraded, right? Because if your computer crashes every 30 to 60 minutes, like, hard crashes, kernel panics, that's bad. But I don't know. I feel like Apple probably knows what the stability is like. Certainly it feels shakier than we wish the Mac operating system ever would feel. But early releases of all major updates are like that. And certainly, as we said in the last show, it doesn't live up to the billing as a stability release, like as it was pitched. But it's hard for me to gauge exactly how dire it is. And I still remember the bad old days of 10.5.0 and even 10.6.0. And like, the zero releases back in the old days were just so much worse. Like it would make your computer unusable. But Marco's right in that they didn't push those. They didn't automatically download those and throw things in your face to tell you to upgrade. Like, no one even knew Leopard was out until most of us had suffered through 10.5.0, 10.5.1, and 10.5.2. So it's a different world.
Yeah. Tell us about your iPhone, John.
Do we have time for this? I guess we do. My iPhone is full.
What is that? So wait, what size did you get?
I didn't. Here's the thing. When we've all seen the Google ads where they like, part of their advertising campaign is they show up that little dialogue that says, like, never see this again. And it's a little iOS dialogue that comes up and says, like, whatever it says, your iPhone is full or you're out of storage. I don't remember the exact wording, but that's been in ad campaigns for Android devices, specifically for Google Android devices, I think, for a while now. And I had never seen that. And so when it appeared, my first question was, how big is this phone? Because I had forgotten. It's an iPhone 7. I bought it a long time ago. I don't remember what size I got. I was surprised to learn that I got a 128, which I normally don't do. Like, I normally get the smaller size. So I'm like, oh, I don't have that much stuff on it, and it's not a big deal. It used to be that, you know, back in the old days when the cameras on phones and iPod Touches really sucked, the biggest thing on your phone or iPod Touch, which I keep saying because that's what I had at the time, was your music. And I was like, oh, I'm not going to put my whole music collection on there. I'll just put my 3-star plus playlist on there, which is like the songs that I like from my music collection, essentially. I'll just put them on there, and that's not that big. And that's the biggest thing that's going to be on my phone, and my music collection doesn't grow that much. So all I need to do is get a phone or iPod Touch that fits my music collection, and I'll be fine. But now the cameras on phones, and maybe iPod Touches, are super awesome, and we all take lots of pictures with it, and the pictures are big. And I filled my 128 gig phone with, yes, my music collection, which doesn't get that much bigger very often, but with photos. I filled it with photos. So, you know, you go to, like, the dialog box up, says go to manage storage. You look at what's taking up all this room, and you're like, guess what? Photos. And then second place, music. And then third place, everything else, right? So now I'm in this situation, and I'm like, I saw those ad campaigns. I'm like, yeah, but if your phone fills up, like, you could fix that, right? It's pretty easy to fix. And to its credit, iOS has this pretty nice storage management screen where it will suggest a whole bunch of things you can do to get space back, and it will tell you exactly how much space you'll get back in priority order, the biggest things first. You can do the thing where you let the operating system offload apps that you don't use, and it tells you what the consequences of that are, and it tells you how much space you'll save. You can get rid of attachments on messages, and it tells you how much space you'll save. You can delete old messages older than a year, and it tells you how much space that will save, and all sorts of stuff like that. I was really impressed with that screen, which I had never seen before. My problem was I didn't want to do any of those things. What I wanted to happen was iCloud Photo Library to say, I am now going to eject photos that you haven't looked at in a long time and save only the tiniest of thumbnails for them. And I'm going to do that across your entire photo library, shrinking it dramatically. And I should have done that 17 hours ago when I saw you were running out of room on your phone, but I didn't. Instead, I waited for your phone to completely fill up and then stopped you in the middle of filming a video of your cute dog. And popped up, literally in the middle of filming a video of my cute dog, and popped up a dialogue that says, your phone is full. I'm like, well, make it unfull. Like, the whole point of optimized storage on my phone, get rid of photos that I haven't looked at. Like, I have thousands of photos that I have never looked at on my phone. Get them off my phone. That's the whole point of optimized storage, right? And I know people have had the same frustration on their Mac, that, like, they set their Mac to optimize storage, and their Mac's disk fills up, and they're like, come on, photos. Optimize storage. Like, the whole point is they're stored in the cloud. I don't need the full res ones here. Download them on demand. Get the full res ones off of my system. So I didn't know what to do. So I'm like, I guess I'll try deleting some big apps. I guess I'll finally delete GarageBand that I never use because it's like 600 megs or whatever. You know, like, I deleted some stuff thinking maybe it's just a lag. Maybe, you know, the photos thing will just takes a little while to catch up and it'll flush stuff out. But sure enough, like a couple of hours later, phone full again. I deleted some more stuff. Next day, phone full again. Like, every time I try to take a picture, it would happen literally when I'm taking pictures and videos, just like on the ads, because that's when, like, the thing would fill up or hit some threshold. So I was like, I have no choice. I have to basically turn off iCloud Photo Library to convince it to delete these photos off my Mac, because it's just not doing it. So I turned off iCloud Photo Library, and it said, do you want to keep these photos in your Mac, or do you want to trash them? And I said, go ahead and trash them, because they're all safe in the cloud. They're all safe on my Mac. Like, you know, they're in a million different places. I don't need them to be on my phone. I never look at them on my phone anyway. And by the way, remember, the photos on my photo library is not the family photo library. It's just my photos. The family photo library belongs to my wife. So I'm only talking about a tiny subset of the vast amount of photos I have. And I import all of my photos into the family photo library, like, painfully and manually. There's no good way to do this. I wasn't really worried about the data, right? Because it's not the real photos, and they're all in the other thing. So I told it to delete my photo library, and I clicked delete, and it went through, and now it's like it's removing space, and I'm seeing space come back. I got many, many gigs free, and I'm like, all right, I've solved this problem. And then I found myself in the managed storage screen. I guess I was just trying to look at what the progress was or whatever. And I noticed in the managed storage screen, it said, here's some things you can do to save space. And one of the top items was, you should enable iCloud Photo Library because that'll save you 50 gigs. And I was like, what? How will enabling iCloud Photo Library save me 50 gigs? Is it thinking, well, I see on your phone you've got gigs and gigs of photos, but if you enable iCloud Photo Library, I can upload all those to the cloud and then dump the full res versions, leaving only the thumbnail, saving you 50 gigs? Like, that's the only way I could reason about that. Like, that's how it was telling me it would think it would save space. And I would say, look, let me tell you, I had it enabled, and that's when my phone filled, and it didn't seem like it saved me space. But anyway, because it offered that to me, I said, all right, I'll take that bet, phone. I'll enable iCloud Photo Library now. Let's see if you save me 50 gigs of space.
You're beating me up about setting my clock back, and this is the sort of thing that you do?
Like I said, to clarify, like, these photos are all safe and sound somewhere else. Like, this is not the real family photo library. Like, this is just me versus the phone to see. Like, you know, if you're going to tell me that I'm going to save 50 gigs, but I'll enable it. And so I enabled it, and I think what I did was I enabled it so quickly after I had disabled it that it hadn't deleted all the photos on my phone. It had just deleted many, many gigs of them. And I re-enabled it, and it went through this thing that said, you know, uploading photos. And I was like, oh, no, is it uploading like duplicates of these photos? Surely it knows that it has already uploaded all these. Like, and it did. It figured it out. It said, it's like, I got to upload like 9,000 photos. And it was like, oh, I'm all done. Because, you know, all those photos were already uploaded. So it didn't actually re-upload them. No duplicates. And then it just sat there in a steady state. So I'm like, well, this technique worked. Disable iCloud Photo Library. Tell it to delete. Wait a short time for it to delete several gigs, then re-enable it, let it figure out that everything that's on the phone has already been uploaded, and let it just say, well, there's nothing for me to do. I guess everything's fine on this phone. So that is my update on my full phone. I'm not sure if I dealt with it in the right way. I'm not sure what the right way really would be. And just to go through the things that I didn't want to do, I didn't want to delete message attachments just because I'm stubborn and I'm waiting for that stupid iCloud message sync thing to happen. So that all my messages would be in the cloud and I could delete them locally. Like, I didn't want, you know, people send me cute videos. I don't want to save them to my video library, but I don't want them to be gone, right? I didn't want to delete a bunch of applications, especially ones that I might not be able to re-download from the store, although there's fewer of them these days because of the 64-bit thing that killed a lot of my cool 32-bit apps.
RIP, flight control.
Yeah. I didn't want to delete any big games and stuff that I play, because I may not play them that often, but when I do want to play them, I like the fact that it's there and I can just launch it and play with it. I didn't want to delete any of my music because I already had a minimal set of my music on there, and I didn't want to stream music. Like, it was just another option that I could have done, but I like the fact that the music is on there. What I did want to happen was for the photos to flush out. So anyway, I took the phone up on its bet, and it sure didn't save me 50 gigs, but my phone is no longer full again, and I guess what this means is the next time I get a phone, I'll be sure to get the 256 or whatever the biggest size they offer is, because now I'm apparently one of those people who fills his phone.
I will say, a useful tip that somebody told me somewhere, or I found somewhere when I was setting up my laptop last, is, you know, on iOS, you're screwed. You're up to the iCloud gods to do what they need to do with optimizing storage, which they seem to not do reliably. But on the Mac, I strongly recommend this tactic where, you know, if you're going to have, like, your main Mac download all the files and not download originals, fine. Do it normally. If you're going to use iCloud Photo Library and have it optimize storage on a Mac, if you have an idea of how much disk space you want that to use at most, create a sparse bundle disk image and locate your photos library on that, and you can just have it auto-mount by adding it as a login item in your login items. And so I have a disk image called Photos that I set as a maximum size of, I think it was like 20 gigs that I chose, something like that. That's why I've been doing it on my new old laptop. And it is wonderful because it filled that up maybe two-thirds of the way and then just stopped. And so now I can control exactly how much disk space it uses, and it will never exceed the limit on this sparse bundle. It's glorious. I don't know why this isn't a setting. They should just have a setting.
Can, can you imagine some other way to implement that feature that doesn't involve disk image? Imagine if they just had a setting.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, imagine a storage limit setting. That would be amazing. But they don't have that. So in the absence of them being willing to add such an incredibly useful, obvious setting that everyone needs on a laptop because the SSDs are expensive and small, make a sparse bundle disk image and disk utility, and you can locate the photo library on that, add it as a login item, and it automatically mounts, and everything just works, except you have a defined limit to how big your photos library can be, and it will stay under it. It is wonderful.
I was going to make fun of the inefficiency of the solution, because now you've got like another layer of pseudo file system that all your I/O is going through, which, you know, can't be efficient. But I do something even worse for network time machine backups. What I probably should be doing is, I think what both you use is quotas on Synology, where you set the quotas per user, right?
Yep, works great. Mm-hmm.
Yep. I think I actually do have the quotas set, but I think I'm slightly over provisioned in typical fashion. Usually I just need, if things start to fill up, I use the TMU tail thing to delete historic backups, because at least in the case of Time Machine, there is a physical way for me to do what the system should be doing anyway, which is cleaning up old backups. But sometimes it gets cranky when you get close to too much space. So I have on my network Time Machine volume a non-sparse disk image as a space-filling placeholder. Like many gigs of a space-filling placeholder.
Oh, my word.
And if I ever get to the point where I'm really super full and Time Machine needs like too much, needs scratch space to get it out of its bind, guess what? I take the space filler, chuck it in the trash, empty, you know, delete it, resolve the Time Machine thing, and put back the space filler, which is, I you know, it's disgusting. It reminds me of that awesome story. I hope it's not apocryphal, because it's one of my favorite internet stories of the experienced game developer who has some mandate to fit all some, I forget, I'm going to messing up the details, but to fit all the assets for this game in a certain amount of memory. And it's like getting to be crunch time and they have to ship and they're like, you know, 200K. This is the old days of PC gaming, like 200K over their RAM limit. And they can't figure out how to wring any more RAM out. And at the beginning of project, he'd made a 2 megabyte RAM buffer as a static variable in some C file. And he just comments that line out and says, done, ship it. Anyway, my thing is obviously much worse than that and not clever at all, but it is a thing that I do, and it has actually come in handy.
I want to make so much fun of you, John, but that is actually very, very clever.
It's not. It's stupid. I should use quotas, but I'm just saying it's a thing.
Well,
I do.
Fair.
I mean, is that much worse than my crazy sparse bundle hack?
Yeah, well, you know, the sparse bundle, like, the sparse bundle thing just makes me so angry about how these automated systems, like, for version one, fine, but this is obviously a thing that people want. They want more control over how much space your thing is taking, and if the optimizing really worked the way it was supposed to, where you don't have to worry about, we'll take care of it, no one would complain. Like, that's a great goal, but many years later, on all their systems, their sort of optimized storage thing does not work the way people expect. Like, it lets it fill up. It doesn't catch it before it fills up. In scenarios where I'm flooding. I mean, I suppose video, I am kind of flooding the phone with lots of data. But, like, it's not unforeseeable by the system that we're getting close to the disk storage limit. And when it does hit the limit, it seems like no part of the system scrambles to get your space back. They're like, yeah, you've hit your limit. No, we're not going to do anything about it. Like, maybe that demon will wake up and consider thinning some, but maybe it won't. Like, we're not in a hurry. Is it why? Is there some urgency about this? Perhaps you should go to the settings app on the managed storage screen so you can clear that red badge. Well, it makes you look at that, by the way. It makes you look at that managed storage screen to clear that badge every time it tells you that message. I know that because it would tell me that message a lot. And there's no way to get rid of it until you go into that screen and let it grind away and say, here's all the things you can do to save space. I'm like, you know what you could do to save space? Get rid of some photos.
Goodness.
Thanks to our sponsors this week, Fracture, Aftershocks, and Linode, and we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental.
How's the weather up there, Marco?
Cold, rainy.
How's the forecast, though?
Oh,
there it is.
There we go. It's overcast.
Yeah, nicely done. Nicely done. We'll be here all week, kids. Anyway, so
wow.
So you've released a Mac app. Congratulations.
Yeah, my second Mac app. Don't forget Quitter.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
I noticed that on my system the other day when I was like command spacing it. I think I mistyped and Quitter came up. I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, so I released Forecast. It's a Mac app. It's for producing your own podcasts. It is an MP3 encoder and chapter tool, and lets you input some of the MP3 metadata right in the app. And this, I mentioned this on this show a number of times over the last 2 years or so that I've been developing it. It is a parallelized version of the lame MP3 encoder under the hood. The parallelization is actually done fairly boringly. It's done entirely outside of lame. By the way, lame is a terrible name. That's kind of like an ableist problem name now, but this was named a very long time ago before we were as aware of these things, and I didn't name it, but it happens to be the best MP3 encoder. So I apologize for the terrible name, but it is called the lame MP3 encoder. It is the pretty much the only way you can encode an MP3 legally today without using software that had a pre-existing deal with the Fraunhofer Institute that was the creator of the MP3 originally back in like the late 80s, and it was them whose patents expired this past spring. When their patents expired, they stopped licensing their encoder at any price. Believe me, I tried. So the only way to encode MP3s legally today, if you don't already have a copy or a license of the lame MP3 encoder, like Apple does with the iTunes and Logic, is to use the lame open source project. So anyway, that's what Forecast does. And the parallelization happens outside of that. I basically split the file into chunks, send them each to a copy of the regular standard libmp3 lame that comes with the source distribution from Homebrew, rejoin those chunks after they are encoded into one contiguous mp3 file. Because as I mentioned earlier in the show, during the question about dynamic ad insertion, mp3 file format is easily spliced and easily rejoined and hacked up like that without causing too many problems, as long as you're a little bit careful. So that's what it does. And it is optimized for the workflow that me and some of my podcaster friends have, which is we create mp3 chapters as markers in Logic Pro. You can also do this from Adobe Audition. And I don't think there's a good way to do it from Audacity, unfortunately. I know people are trying. I'm not yet aware of a way to do it. But anything that can export markers as metadata in a WAV file, Forecast will try to import that as chapters. You can also create them manually, but I wouldn't recommend that because the interface for doing so is awful, because I don't do that. Also, it's all a table view with Cocoa bindings, and that makes a bunch of weird little behaviors and inconsistencies and bugs that I need to get rid of by dumping Cocoa bindings, but that's a lot of work and I haven't gotten there yet. Anyway, so I released this app, and I released it for free for lots of reasons that I don't know, I can talk about if you want to, if you care. I've talked a little bit about some of this stuff on Under the Radar, but I don't know, what do you guys want to know? Where should I start here?
So what was the motivation? It was simply just efficiency?
Yeah, pretty much. It was, I wanted, first of all, the way I was encoding this show before was by using the command line version of lame. And I was doing that, I wasn't using the built-in MP3 encoder in Logic, which is the Fraunhofer encoder, which is actually a little bit better quality for low bitrate speech and also a little bit faster. But I wasn't using that because I wanted, as part of my workflow, to automate things like putting in the right artwork for the show, putting in the right podcast title and episode number and everything. So I had like some shell scripts to do that before, and I would shell out to the lame MP3 encoder on the command line. And encoding an episode of the show would take like 4 or 5 minutes. That's to an impatient programmer, that's just death. Like, just have to sit there and wait. And every time, like, if I wanted to change the file, well, I have to then wait another 5 minutes for it to re-encode, and it was a pain. So I've always loved hacking audio stuff, as you can tell from some of my career choices, always loved it, always loved dealing with audio. And so I decided, you know what, there has to be a way to make this parallel. I have all these cores sitting around doing nothing on my computer while one core works its butt off for 5 minutes. This is incredibly offensive to me. let me figure out a way to solve this. And in addition, I realized, like, if I control like a GUI version of the encoder, I can save myself some time in other ways. For instance, we host this podcast on Squarespace. Well, we host the website and the feed on Squarespace. The files are hosted at Libsyn. And that's a setup I recommend, by the way. But anyway, the Squarespace requires that you paste in the file size and the duration of the podcast file that you're hosting elsewhere. It doesn't just fetch that, it requires that you paste it in. So I figure, like, oh, if I can have a tool that like helps me easily copy those things to the clipboard, I can save a few steps there. If I have a tool that can maybe pre-fill certain things based on what I did last for that same podcast, I can save some time there. I also wanted to get involved with chaptering my show, our show. And, the Germans kind of convinced me to do it. The Germans are frustratingly right a lot of the time. And I love the Germans. Anyway, so they convinced us all over time. They wore us down and convinced us all that we should probably have chapters on our show, and wanted to do that. And I was not happy with the state of the tools to do that 2 years ago. They were pretty minimal and almost non-existent. And so I wanted to basically solve all these problems at once. And so I did. I made an app that was basically my ideal app for podcast encoding and post-production work. I basically made it for myself to save myself time, and it does dramatically. So it saves me tons of time every week now that I produce multiple shows. And even if I just produce this one, it would still be worth doing. And then I had a private beta with many of our podcasting friends, you know, probably most notably the people at Relay, you know, Mike, Steven, Jason Snell. They were wonderful beta testers, and they uncovered lots of little bugs over the years, and we've hopefully fixed them all. And here we are.
So why free? And I know you talked about this on Under the Radar, but what's the kind of short version?
The main reason is that my expected number of paid customers for this, like if I would have charged money for this, the total number of paid customers I would expect to get is maybe 100. Like, there aren't that many podcast producers relative to other professions. Among podcast producers, there aren't that many of them who are willing to try some random tool like this from me. And because the volume would be so low, I would have to price it at like $50 or more to make it worthwhile. And I just figured the market would be so small that, you know, if this was a paid app, the market would be so small that the total amount of money I would make from this is, you know, not that great. And the cost of supporting an app that was paid to that level is very high. Like, if someone pays $50 for an app or more, they expect a certain level of support for that money. And I did not want to offer that level of support for the anticipated very low customer volume that this would probably generate. And then secondarily, I realized, like, there's actually, like, strategic benefits to this for Overcast, where if I supply the encoder and I control the encoder's UI and features for a bunch of popular podcasts, and I also control the podcast app, then I can do cool features. I can implement new features. I can extend the implementations of current features. So, for instance, one of the features that observant listeners might have noticed in ATP and in Overcast over the last couple of months is that I've had the ability to basically create invisible chapters. Chapters that don't show up in the chapter list, but that at a certain timestamp show a certain image or a link or both. But just are not in the table of contents, not in the list of chapters. This is part of the MP3 chapter spec. They actually say, like, oh, not every chapter needs to be a member of a table of contents. You could, for instance, show something at a certain time. But no apps implemented that, both in the encoding or the playing side. Because I controlled the encoder and the player, I implemented that. And so now we have this cool feature that we can do with podcasts where you can have invisible chapters. So if you want to show a certain link, like right now, or a certain picture right now, without disrupting the semantic structure of the chapter that you're currently in, or if you want to show links or images at certain times without having the rest of the show even have chapters, without having a chapter structure for the rest of the show at all, you can now do that. That's a cool feature. And I'm only able to do that feature because I control an encoder and a player. And so I realized, like, the more people who use this encoder, the better it works out for Overcast and for podcasting as a whole. And so I decided, you know what, because of the combination of those strategic benefits and the fact that any paid income would probably be pretty small and would probably bring a large support burden for that smallness, I decided free was the better approach. So it's free.
But it's not just free. You have an interesting business model, sort of, at the bottom of the forecast page at overcast.fm/forecast.
Oh, yeah. I say something along the lines of, like, you know, if you use this and you find it useful for your podcasts, I would appreciate if you occasionally promoted Overcast. And you don't have to do it. It's not a requirement. And if it's a show where that doesn't make sense, like, I was thinking of, like, You Look Nice Today. Like, I, you know, it's not really in production anymore, but, like, a show like You Look Nice Today, or even, like, Due by Friday, which I kind of view as its, like, spiritual successor, it doesn't make sense to promote things in a show like that. Like, that doesn't contextually fit. It would sound weird. So, like, I don't want you promoting Overcast in a show like that. But if you have a show where, which most people do, of, like, at the end you have, like, oh, please, you know, rate us on iTunes and subscribe in Stitcher or whatever else, occasionally throw an Overcast there. That's it. That's my business model. It's like, if you feel like it and if you can, I'd appreciate if you promoted Overcast sometimes. But you don't have to.
Where are you hiding this application? I read the webpage when you linked it on Twitter, but now I went looking for it. Marco.org/apps doesn't list it. That seems like an oversight.
Yeah, I still have a lot of places I need to update this. It was kind of a soft launch. I basically launched it on Twitter. The Overcast site does not link to it from anywhere yet.
So where is it? Like, because I'm realizing I don't even know.
Overcast.fm/forecast.
All right. I don't even know what the icon looks like.
The icon is a tongue-in-cheek joke. It was created by the wonderful Forgotten Towel, the designer who does all of the Relay FM artwork. I hired him to do this icon, and
it's so good.
0.9, come on. You're better than that.
What is it, a 1.0? No.
You released it. You got to go with 1.0.
Yeah, Apple released High Sierra, too.
Don't you know that Semver has weird problems with version numbers that begin with 0? You don't know that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I should probably put the icon on the app page.
I downloaded it to see the icon. So what is the joke?
You don't get the joke? Oh, it's so good. It's the German flag, but an F.
All right. Yeah, I see that. I thought it was like some sort of, I should have known, some sports thing, like it's a sports logo or something. But yeah, no, I see the German flag colors now. Yes.
Yeah, and a few Germans got it, and therefore that made it worth it.
So how do you, I look at this application, and how do you feel about, I mean, I know this is just, it's just like a utility, and you're like, you don't really care that much about the UI. It's a very utilitarian application for all the reasons you listed, and even some parts of the UI you don't even use. But it also doesn't look like you spent much time worrying about what the window would look like you might have if this was going to be a commercial application. Like, it's just kind of there. Like, it's not, things aren't badly aligned, except for maybe a little bit too much space between the buttons and the rest of the thing, but it certainly is not... Not a particularly showy application, let's say.
No, it really isn't at all. And I take full ownership of that this is not a pretty UI. This is not a highly polished UI. If you do what I said I never do, which is if you manually enter chapters, it's really unpolished. So this is not, you know, something that I'm really proud of the UI. This to me is a highly functional app. You know, most of what I like... And I mentioned on the show a few times before that I also have a tool that helps align double ender files and remove drift in them. This is not that tool. And I understand why people think it might be, because I talked about that tool before. This is a separate tool. That tool is an even less polished command line app that has tons of weird bugs and edge cases if you don't use it exactly the way I use it. And even then, sometimes if you do. And so that is nowhere near releasable state. It doesn't even have a GUI at all, and even the command line version is really not particularly releasable. This is a small step above that. You know, this has a GUI. It is not a good interface. It is not a polished interface. But this is a tool for pro workflows that are like mine. Even if no one else ever uses it, it works great for me, and so I'm happy with that. It's hard to justify spending a lot of time on it, like polishing it up, when I also am maintaining Overcast and having to update that and move that forward and everything. So it's probably never going to be incredibly polished in the UI. I just want to make sure that it's really useful. And so, you know, like many pro tools, it's kind of ugly, but just functional.
You should have a drawer.
I actually had a drawer in one of the early versions. I was thinking, like, you know, it would be like one of the things that is an obvious next step for features for this app is to have a little player and to have it like preview and simulate, like, you know, how the chapters would look in a player and be able to seek to them and play them and everything to make sure that they're right.
You got to bring back the old visualizer from Overcast.
Yeah. I still have all that code, obviously. So if you're going to add a player to this, a drawer is kind of the obvious way to do it.
No, it is not obvious. It's the obvious joke way to do it. Didn't they just deprecate that like this year?
I probably. No, I mean, I wouldn't do it, but I was tempted to do it.
Yeah, a floating brush metal window is the clear way to do that.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Textured. Sorry, it's not brush metal.
Yeah, textured. Yeah. Looked like iSync.
All right, so I have two questions for you. Number one, do you have any kind of analytics anywhere, just so you know, like, was this market as small as you thought, or have you had, you know, 11 billion downloads and turns out you might have miscalculated?
I can figure this out now or later. I don't need to do this like in the app, and so I haven't yet. in order to distribute this app outside of the App Store, which, and honestly, like, I wasn't trying to make some kind of giant political statement by not being in the App Store. There was just no need for me to be in the App Store, so I wasn't. I didn't feel that it was worth the burdens of being in the App Store for no benefit, really. So I'm not in the App Store, so I had to build in distribution functionality. I had to build in auto-updating. And the way you do auto-updating in Mac apps is through the Sparkle framework. This is how pretty much everyone does it. Everyone who's used a Mac app that is not from the App Store has seen the little windows that say, like, you know, an update's available. Do you want to install now? Remind me later, or skip this version. And you click install now, and it shows, like, a little, like, you know, progress bar, and then it quits and relaunches the app. There's a reason why those are the same across pretty much every app. They all use the same framework called Sparkle. And so the way Sparkle works is once a day or whatever, when you launch the app, it checks a server's RSS feed, and it's a special RSS feed that is for versions of the app. So for me to distribute this, I had to basically build all that. And I when I made Quitter, I built like a very, very basic version of that. That's just basically all like shell scripts that would generate static files and then upload them to my server. For Forecast, this is an Overcast product. I wanted this to live on the Overcast servers. I wanted to finally do like a little bit better of a job. So I kind of made my own crappy little version of iTunes Connect for it, where like I can upload a build and a script on the server reads the build number and the version number out of that build, signs it for Sparkle update mechanism, like there's a signature involved, so signs it for that, and then creates like an entry. Then I can enter release notes in that entry, and I can say whether it's released or not. So I can actually very easily add a thing to the system that remembers how many people check that RSS feed every day and reports to me roughly how many users there are. Or I can just log like how many downloads the file has, which I also don't do.
Sure.
I probably should be doing that, but I'm not. But overall, the response I've gotten on Twitter so far has been huge. It's been way bigger than I expected, and I think this is really a good sign. There's a lot more podcast producers out there than the people I know. It isn't so many that I regret releasing it for free, because I think if it wasn't free, many of them wouldn't try it because they don't know me and this is just some random thing. But because it's free, it is spreading pretty wide, wider than I expected it to spread so quickly, especially since I'm linking to it from nowhere on the site. So far it's going pretty well.
Good. And because it's my favorite thing to ask, what was the either hardest or crummiest part of the entire process? And I think that your Under the Radar episode talked about a lot of the like, oh, the app is done, but there's so much more to do. And like you were talking about, like your Marco Connect, you know, and or your fake iTunes Connect, you know, all that had to be written. But over the entire process from start to finish, including all this administrivia you had to do, what would you say was either the hardest or the most difficult or crummiest part to deal with?
By far the hardest part of this app is just learning AppKit. You know, it's learning how to make Mac apps. I had made Quitter before, and I made a couple of little like experimental dumb crap before that. But this is the first time that I really have made a Mac app of any kind of substance. Now, the good thing is, you know, AppKit provides a lot of really rich functionality built in. So like the entire document model, I don't have to worry that much about like windowing, opening, saving, save as, stuff like that. Like a lot of that comes for free. And so that's pretty great. But the way that the actual UI works, like the way those table views work and the text fields inside the table views and the formatters and the bindings to an array controller and all this weird stuff, you know, to an iOS developer mainly, it might as well be Android. Like it's so different from the way iOS works that it's like starting over from zero. So I'm making Mac apps as though I'm a complete novice, because for the Mac I am. That has been the hardest part, is that, you know, I'm used to working at a certain speed and proficiency and design proficiency on iOS that I just don't have when making macOS apps. So that's been a very, very slow learning process. And it's also just harder on the Mac because the APIs have a lot more legacy because they're much older. So the APIs are a lot clunkier. They have not gotten nearly as much attention in the last decade as iOS has, so they are in many ways a lot harder to use or have a lot of antiquated or clunky things you have to do to use them. And the biggest problem with all of it is that because iOS is so incredibly popular and macOS development relatively isn't, it's very hard to find answers if you have questions for macOS development. There's not, like with iOS, you can search anything under the sun and you're going to get 1,000 Google results. Half of them are going to be really great tutorials on like exactly what you have to do, or great Stack Overflow answers on exactly the problem you're having. And on macOS, that's not the case most of the time. Most of the time, what you're searching for, you will get either nothing helpful or like one ancient mailing list post that you have to like scan through the web version of a mailing list to find somebody who might maybe be talking about what you're talking about. It's a very different world.
I'm just trying to think of an excuse to use this application. Maybe I should produce a podcast.
Wow. It's funny. You're on so many podcasts, but you've never produced one.
Drop artwork here. Okay, why are you yelling at me?
It looked better. I don't know. This isn't like me designing macOS apps. It's like the way everyone designs Windows apps. It's like, I don't know what the hell is good here. Like, just throw something there that looks good to me.
This is where you start using the guide snap things in Interface Builder, or did you not use Interface Builder for this at all?
No, I use it, and I use the guide snap things. No, I mean, and like, I told you, like, I built most of the interface with Cocoa bindings, just so I wouldn't have to learn a lot of the intricacies of table views.
And then all the experienced Mac developers scolded you for it.
Yeah, and then everyone's like, oh, yeah, don't use Cocoa bindings. Like, yeah, thanks a lot. It is really nice to do certain, like, and, you know, Cocoa bindings are great for, like, really simple stuff, like enabled, disabled states of certain buttons, tracking certain, you know, properties or things being nil or things like that. There's a lot of value to Cocoa bindings, but like for me to fix the main problem the app has, which is the manual entry of chapters is very clunky and weird, that is going to basically require dumping bindings for the table view. And that's going to be I'm not going to say it's going to be a huge pain, but it's going to be a decent amount of work at least. Especially because I'm totally unfamiliar with it. If it was iOS, I could do it in half a day. But because it's macOS, it's going to take me a lot longer than that. And the good thing is that the app has gotten such a strong reception that I'm actually motivated to do things like this, to fix weird bugs that don't affect me personally. But I do have to also keep that in check with, like, this is not my primary job. My primary job is Overcast, and I need to make sure that Overcast is not going to suffer from me working too much on Forecast. The good thing is, I don't think it's very likely, because like I've been working on a Forecast for 2 years, and the way I usually work on it is I fix some things I've wanted to fix for a while, like for over like a week, and then I don't touch it for 6 months, and then I spend another week tweaking it up, and then I go to the 6 months without touching it, because it pretty much works. Like, it doesn't need a lot of attention, so hopefully this won't be a huge time sink, and I don't think it will.
How is Forecast choosing where to put its window when I hit Command N?
I don't know.
Random number generator? Like,
I mean, so there's that weird like thing in Interface Builder, that little like window graphic thing where you say like, all right, kind of position it kind of in the middle of the window on the left or something. Like, there's something in Interface Builder that lets you specify that.
Yeah, it is kind of in the middle and the left. I wondered if this was a conscious choice or it does remember the window position between quits, which I'm assuming you're picking up for free as part of like the save restore.
I think
save
so.
Thing. But if you close all the windows and hit Command N, a new window appears in a location that, I mean, it's not random. It's always the same place, but it's like off center to the left, kind of the middle vertically.
Yeah, I've selected that in the thing in Interface Builder that does that. I wasn't aware that was a global. I figured it would just use the last one, and that would be like the very first time it ever made a window, it would create it there.
No.
All right. See, this is the problem. Like, I don't know how to do this on macOS yet. Like,
yeah, that's fine. The other thing that surprises me is that you use a Mac every day, but like, you know, when you laid out like the preferences dialog, that's laid out like no preference dialog in any Mac app, and you use Mac apps all the time. Like, you see preference dialogs, but
there's like three preferences.
I know, and yet surprisingly laid out in kind of a weird Marco kind of way. And the thing is this is the thing I want to emphasize. Just because you use a Mac application all the time doesn't mean you consciously know, like, if I'm making a dialogue from scratch and I have like two text boxes, two radio buttons and a button, how do I put them so it looks like correct?
Right. And I had so, like, this stuff took me so long to try to figure out because I am not a Mac developer. And it was very, very slow going. It's like I was a novice, because for the Mac, I am a novice. And even using a Mac for all these years.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You don't think about it if you're not actually dragging the controls out. Because when you see like a Mac dialog box, you're like, oh, it looks more or less right. But then you see one that doesn't quite look right. There's something off about it, but you can't quite place it. And it's like, you know, what would fix this? Is it just because the button on the bottom is centered? Is it, you know, what is the problem about? I don't know. Anyway, it's fine.
I appreciate you.
Your icon does look like a sports logo, though. I don't know why I keep thinking that.